This is Richard Verona continuing my oral history interview with Joey Welsh. Today is November 29th, 2005. And Joey, we were talking just a bit off the record there about some of your experiences here at home working with the Gold Star Mothers, and also about, we led into how tough the mothers of the MIA POWs are. And you talked about how you felt like there were still people there, or there are still people alive. Can you comment on that and tell me why you think that?
Well, no, I'm saying that when in 1973, when the plane lands, and Jeremy Dalton, who was the man who got off and, you know, was said his little spiel, they knew, number one, that there were still guys there, okay? And this, we had there was a special secret site that was set up through special imagery, heat imagery. They were following the movement of our POWs, okay? You know, and of course this was all classified and run mostly, you know, like CIA stuff. And like I said, they had indigenous, very well-trained indigenous personnel that were, you know, dug in there to, you know. I mean, this site was really well concealed. I imagine it must be in, maybe 15 years after the fact of them coming back in 73. I don't know if it got through their conscience or what, but a couple E-67 Air Force guys that were doing this work finally said, "The hell with it, I'm telling." You know?
And this was, who was this exactly?
There were two Air Force techs that were, there were Air Force people that were monitoring these systems. Well, see, we did that. We put out sensory things, but they had high-speed satellite imagery and heat imagery and all. I mean, they know who they were following, and it was just very, very, very secret. And in 73, when they all got off and said, you know, there's no more one, there was never any POWs or MIAs in Laos. That was the first thing they lied about. And we have all of our men accounted for. Well, that was untrue because they held on and, well, we have the Russians released the records to us that, yes, they did wind up with some POWs. Okay. And what? Why is it beyond anyone's imagination when that guy walked out of Papua New Guinea from the Second World War after 47 years?
Right.
Hey, you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was still fighting the war for 47 years. He was living there. Okay? So the idea is, and, you know, that's one thing when I went through SEER instructor course, and we all, you know, get into a lot of that, being Colonel Rowe, Nick Rowe, who was assassinated in the Philippines in 89. Do you know who Colonel Rowe was?
Why don't you tell the people listening to this recording?
Okay, Colonel Nick Rowe was a lieutenant in the Special Forces, and he was with the Mountain Yard Company, and he had two other advisors with him, and, you know, they trained the Mountain Yards and led the Mountain Yards at that time, the early 60s, 64, 65, and they went into a hell of a battle. Rocky Veresky, I'm not saying it right, but it's V-E-R-S-C-A-E, him and another guy were the Americans. Well, they just totally overran them, you know, and captured all of them. Well, Rocky, from the very start, just said no. screw you. No, no, no. And they were beating him and everything. He would not sit down. He would not do nothing. He would not cooperate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it didn't take long. You know, most guys, if they get whacked a few times, they said, well, you know, because your best chance of escape is when you're first caught, when everything's in disarray,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Before they get everything set up.
Right, and that, I think that was Rocky's thing, is to keep these guys, if I can keep enough of these guys busy, maybe somebody can, but Colonel Rowe, well, he was a lieutenant then, him and the other guy were already hogtied and beat up, and they couldn't do anything, but they could see him at first. And then they moved him, and he kept on just saying, no, no. And, you know, he was just, he would not. And this went on for hours and hours until they beat him to death.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He was not going to cooperate. I'm not gone. I'm not giving you nothing. Stick it up your ass. You know, you got me. Kill me. Because I ain't. And they went on and on. And they even tried to come. No, not me. Okay, so he was down in South Vietnam and moved all through Southern Vietnam from place to place, bamboo cage, for over 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
He escaped once, and they caught him, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the next time he heard a helicopter, well, you know, they would hear, you know, helicopters, bombs, they'd get bombed. I mean, you know, they, you know, because they were down there. And he just had that opportunity, and he grabbed the weapon and killed the two guards and ran out. And he almost got killed by running out, but they had him in black pajamas. But one of the guys said, wait a minute, he's got a beard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they went down and they picked him up. It was that fast, just like that, over five years. And was over, it's called 5 Years of Freedom,
mm-hmm.
His book.
Yep, I'm aware of it.
Okay. Now, he put Rocky in for the Medal of Honor when he came back. He didn't care about himself. He put Rocky in for the Medal of Honor, okay, because of what he was really trying to do was disrupt them, and hopefully somebody could get away.
Mm-hmm.
And would not. He wasn't going to POW camp. He wasn't going nowhere. He was going to escape or die. And but it went on for hours, the beating. And he never went for nothing. He was just like, totally screw you. So they killed him.
Mm.
They put him in for the Medal of Honor. He got it the year before last.
Oh, that's great.
Well, this, I think he escaped in 1968-69. But that's the way things are. I mean, you know, he only got a Bronze Star for valor, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jesus, and a Purple Heart or two. But he, you know, he escaped once, and he was just, he had beriberi and everything, you know, and he got it, made it to the stream, and, you know, he just collapsed, and they caught him. But they were close to, he could hear, you know, choppers and stuff like that, and he just gave it a shot. And, but he just, you know, they get lax when they're in their own backyard. And they get, he was very fluent. He's very smart. He learned the language. He was very fluent, but he wouldn't let them know that, of course. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, just at that time when they left their guard down, he grabbed a weapon and killed both of them, quite brutally,
mm-hmm.
and ran out in the field, and that's the cover of him putting his hand up and the chopper coming down. And, you know, they grabbed him, and 15 minutes later, he was free.
Wow.
And he actually left the Army, and, you know, so he settled out, and the Army recalled him, Special Operations recalled him and asked him to develop the SEER program for Special Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through the instructor course when he was there. And this was just when, this was before they built the POW camp, because now they actually have the POW camp. You know, and I mean, we're talking 4x4 cages on down to the hanging out there. I mean, it's really good. In fact, he had the model. He was showing us the model. It was like, the model that they had built, and he was explaining it, that it would be built right on the river, you know, and all that. So that's where I got to know Colonel Rowe, because we were doing extraction, and during Vietnam we had the McGuire rig, which was Master Sergeant McGuire was the guy who invented it. And then they went to the Stabo rig. Well, when we were in Sears instructor course...
Did you say Stable Raid?
The McGuire rig.
The McGuire rig?
Rig, yeah.
Okay.
M-C-G-U-I-R-E rig. What it was 300-foot, nylon felling ropes. And what they did was they took it's wide but thin, A7 cargo straps, and they just interlocked them. Mm-hmm. And then they put a half loop with a stitch in it, and where you could put your hand in and then pull down on it. And what you had to do was slide your buttocks under the one little strap, okay? And when you lift off, you grab hold and you interlock your legs and arms, and your wrist is locked in by, a little loop lock above you. Okay, and I've seen guys fall out of them straps because there's only one strap. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And you had no special gear or anything. You just looked in there and you ran with it, and everybody tried to push this strap underneath. As soon as you released from the ground, you would interlock your arms to the guy in the center and wrap your legs. And then just your one arm would be locked above you. And that was the McGuire rig. Then the Stabo rig. Now, the Stabo rig had special harness that you wore, and it had clips, so you would just come down and clip it on, and they could pull a lot more out, too. Well, the Marines invented a really neat one. It looked like a bungee cord. It was called a SPIES, which is a Special Patrol Infiltration and Exfiltration System. What was really cool about this was it hung straight down from the belly, one line. And what happened is you would have your team set up, in a linear formation, like in a line, left to right, left to right for security. And as the guy came down and as it started laying down, the team leader would go along, start at the back, and hook a man in, and, they were helping each other. And then by the time he got to his position, he'd hook in, and I think it held 9 at that time. And your head, you was all hanging straight down. Your head was about as level as to the guy's hips. So you could still use your weapon. You didn't need your hands weren't encumbered at all, so you had, it was nice because, like I said, when they laid it down, everybody could rig, you could run right down your line, hook up your guys, and then off you'd go, plus you could still be shooting, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so we got introduced to that, and we did all three of them, and Colonel Rowe, who vaguely knew me, but then after I became a student, he knew. He realized that I was the only guy in the class who had ever ridden all three of them, because I had been in Vietnam when McGuire rigged, and then the stable rig came later. And so he asked me to do an evaluation on all three of them and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Good, you know, pros and cons. But like he said, we'd say, well, Colonel Rowe, there's got to be somebody over there. And he said to us, well, maybe they don't want to come back. Because, let's face it, some guys did go AWOL. And, you know, were never heard from again. Now, they might have went to Thailand, they might have went to Hong Kong, they might have stayed in Vietnam. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But these technicians I was telling you about, they finally went in front of the Senate subcommittee and all that stuff, and this was after Bo Gritz and them were trying to prove that, you know, they were at the border and all, trying to prove that they had pictures of these guys and all this, and this was like 90, 91, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And this was around Curry's famous, you know, time when he led the board. And that's what really aggravated us the most, was that after all their research and all, it's, you know, impossible that it's very, they really gave the families a lot of hope. It's practically impossible for anybody to have survived. And we have no, let's say, we have no information that confirming that anyone is alive. Okay?
Okay.
However, they were, okay? Because these technicians came out and said, listen, they were alive when you made the deal in 73, okay? And you know the Marine, everybody knows the Marine that everybody says was a collaborator and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was over there 14 years. And he basically was working up in Hanoi, and he was going around and fixing trucks for the military.
Mm-hmm.
And he attempted to slip a note to one guy, and it didn't work. Finally, he slipped a note, and he had to be careful up there because, you know, but he took a chance, and he slipped a note to a French correspondent. To make a long story short, they got him out of there. Well, of course, everybody wanted him to be court-martialed and all that. Hey, you know, yeah, they had him carry a weapon. Was it loaded? No. What they did was they took a young private who was a Jeep driver and tried to, you know, make it look to really kill the morale of the soldiers. He was getting better treatment and all that kind of stuff, and pretty soon he winded up, you know, being taken up north, and then he winded up staying there. And when he came back, you know, he was fully pardoned.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But he was also another one that had seen Caucasian, you know, people,
mm-hmm.
Men, you know, while he was there. So,
Not a Russian.
No, he meant, you know, a white, Caucasian, American, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, they're straggling and got beards and all.
Yeah.
Working in fields and, you know, he had, God knows what else he said, but, I mean, you know, a lot of people say, oh, he should be hung and all. I said, hung? What, are you crazy? The kid's a private, he's sitting in a Jeep, and he gets captured. He's never had a survival class in his life. He's just a Jeep driver. And, you know, he gets, they, you know, what they did is they put you through your process of converting you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this kid's what, 19?
Mm-hmm.
So they figure if we really want to piss these people off and, you know, make it even more discouraging, we're going to let this guy do everything. We're going to treat him good, give him more food, and we're going to take him out with us. And eventually, they actually, in other words, made him, here, you will carry this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, over the years, of course, the POWs and MIAs figured that, you know, he was, you know, went to the other side.
Right.
He never went to the other side. He was just trying to stay alive, and he wasn't a trained, pilot that had been in for 10 years and had an idea that he'd never been through SEER school. But he had sightings. There were some other people who did border operations that had sightings. And these technicians were really, really the ones. I remember watching them testify, and the way they were asking their questions to the committee was really a diversionary tactic, you know? I mean, I was saying, oh, what kind of question is that, you know? But these guys stuck by their guns. Of course, that was all put in Curry's report, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Curry and McCain's a little bit better, but, you know, they're after number one.
Mm-hmm.
But Curry, his commander, and I've seen, you know, what the interview was and what happened with his commander and the reports and everything. He said Curry was there almost 4 months. He went on one or two 24-hour missions. I questioned the day that they supposedly got in this engagement. And every single crew member said, we weren't receiving any fire, sir. He was firing M79s and all that, and the stuff blew back and, you know, hit him in the hand. Well, then he ran down the clinic and said, you know, I just come off of this mission, whatever. And, you know, I guess being the rank he's in, he knew what he's doing and who he's talking to. He was there, and then his commander said, all of a sudden, he was gone, and I heard he got a Purple Heart. He never went through my desk.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hear he gets a Silver Star.
Hmm.
He never went through my desk. And he winded up with a couple Silver Stars and Purple Hearts and all that stuff. He said, I specifically remember because there was a lot of shooting and yelling and hollering, and all them guys were just, you know, he was shooting in and some stuff flew back, so he got a couple of nicks in his hand and he went. The Marine Corps policy then was 3 Purple Hearts, you go home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I believe that's what he got, was 2 or 3 Purple Hearts, and he was gone. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
With the Silver Star and the Bronze Star and all this stuff. And he wasn't. He was only out on a couple missions. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And like the commander said, I very rarely seen him. I know he went out a couple missions. I questioned their one mission. And one day he was gone, and then orders came down for a Bronze Star and a Silver Star. And I knew that nothing happened on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I also knew what happened on that one day where he went to TNC. So, I mean, I just can't see it. Well, because nobody trusts nobody on whatever party you're on, Democrat or Republican, you know, the bottom line is nobody believes, you know, that this stuff was going on. They figured that he was a warrior and stuff like that. And you've read the book Stolen Valor, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about that. What do you think about that book and about the claims about the fraudulent bets?
That was written quite a while ago. That's pretty old.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, they actually have a website. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into that website, and if you, they have a POC for the Army, the Special Forces, the Marines, etc. SEALs, and it's called a search engine thing. If you go in there and you say, hey, well, they do it to me. I just had a guy who works in Detroit with this other guy. Now, the guy who contacted the unit said, listen, you know, I'm a member of 75th Ranger Regiment Association, lifetime member. And I got a guy here named, Jones, that claims he was with your company. And he looked in a website, and he claims to have been with the First Platoon, Satan's Playboys, and How We Rise. But we didn't, you know, we couldn't, you know, really pinpoint anybody. So he said, if anybody knows him or served with him or was there in his platoon with him, you know, contact me. So I left to go the first time, and I read it again, and I said, I'm going to contact him. So I contacted him, and I told him exactly, what we had, and, things like that. Well, come to find out, you know, he was in our company. I did confirm that. Now, we have active members, so we know where they live, active, we know where they live, their phone numbers. And we have the KIAs, and we have the deceased list, which we try to keep up with. And then we have non-member last known location and non-member location unknown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I put out the roster we're working on right now, and we had a count of 1,145 guys,
mm-hmm.
In one way or another. That when we started this 20 years ago, we had no orders on anything because we had no records. They were all classified. So we couldn't verify anything by everybody sent in a copy of their orders, and we took names off of there. And geez, we made up a KI list. I looked at it then, and I looked at it now, and geez, you know. It was just so hard for people to try, unless they had orders in their hand, like Warden of Purple Heart or CIB or an Army Commendation Medal. Then they could say, okay, let's go over here and find this guy. And yes, he is there. And we had David Allen Park, okay, and he was KIA's around March 68. What happened was this guy contacted us and said, hey, this is what we got in this guy. And he was never with us. You know, I mean, he was just, I don't know why they do it. Well, you know, a Supreme Court judge
mm-hmm.
was caught. Brian Dennehy, the big rousty, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He claimed he was a Vietnam vet with Silver Stars.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, and the list goes on and on and on. So what happens is now, I confirmed, I said, I don't know what your motives are. I looked him up. I knew he was good in the 75th. But I can tell you that, yes, he was assigned to that platoon during that time, but I have no address, no phone book, no phone number or anything. But I can tell you this, and he was a retired sergeant major. I said, sergeant major, I can tell you this. Yes, he did serve
mm-hmm.
in our unit. So, you know, he thanked me, and I appreciate it. Then we had another guy who was looking for a friend, you know, a good friend. And it just seems, I don't know why, I guess because they're getting old. But the last couple months, I've seen more guys than ever who are coming forward now and saying, you know, well, here's some pictures, let me check it out and all. What happened was, we were formed in September 67 because, they had, you read Colonel Howard's tribute to Yes, a SOG book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you remember in there, they had CNN at command, CCN rather, Command and Control North, CCC, Command and Control Central, and CCS, Command and Control South. Well, if you remember Project Omega, well, let's put it this way. Everybody remembers Project Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all that was a code saying they are now doing cross-border operations.
Okay.
That's all it meant. Now, they didn't have enough recon people to do the two core area and the rest of Vietnam. So what they did was in the two core area, they formed us, half of it in September 67, half from the LERPs in the 101st, you know, and the other guys were recruited from replacement detachment. They trained for about 3 months and started their operation. And in three corps, which was right below us, and that was CCC's southern area, what they did is they formed us to relieve the special forces from staying in Vietnam looking for them. And we can do that. And then that's when they started Project Omega, which was the transition of them, even though some of them had already been over there. They wanted a nice cover name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so everybody will talk about it. Who's with ours at Project Delta? What did you do? I did this and this. You're lying, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I know what the hell you did. And then, in the meantime, during this transition, there was a team B-36, okay,
mm-hmm.
who nobody mentions or talks about, but they actually, while we were doing the training, were sent up there to take care of CCC, or I should say the Central Highlands. Cutting it in half, we spent more on the western side, you know,
mm-hmm.
on the border side. And when the documents came down, we were actually supporting Project Omega, the transition of CCC is going to do cross-border operations. You're going to do the entire sector of that, you know, corridor.
Mm-hmm.
And who was taking up all of our slack while we were being trained in all this transition going on was B-52,
mm-hmm.
you know, for Project Delta, who had began their cross-border operation. So it was Alpha, Liga, and Sigma. And that was just saying that CCS, CCN, and CCC were now doing cross-border operations pretty extensively. And they have, the unit itself, which was originally run by Singlob, they had Hatchet Force. The Hatchet Force was your reactionary force, and they were honed. And
they were what?
Honed.
Mm-hmm.
H-U-N-G.
Oh, right. Yeah, you talked about those yesterday.
Yeah. They're Chinese. They were of Chinese descent, very warrior-oriented, and, mountain yards were good.
What was the role of the Hatchet Force, and what would they actually do?
Well, the Hatchet Force was basically they had a company, okay? They had a company. And what they would do is, and boy, they did some remarkable things. They went up when they were really, right before Tet, they were really bringing stuff down. And you know how you could blow it up at night and it'd be repaired in the morning. That didn't stop them. They just kept going and going and going. So what they did is they got up on this hilltop and, you know, really dug in. I mean, dug in everything. And they waited till, you know, the first convoy come, and they knocked out the first truck. And then the Air Force and artillery, primarily Air Force, took over for like 2-3 days because nobody could turn around,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they were, you know, they just stopped the resupply. See, that's what they should have been doing in the first place. They gave them a, let's say, a 10-kilometer ratio. That's as far in as you can go. They should have been behind that. They should have been disrupting the supply lines. You disrupt the supply lines, the soldier has nothing to fight with.
Right.
Okay, and we weren't doing that well enough at Ho Chi Minh Trail. No matter if we dropped B-52s all night long, the next day, if they had to use donkey, motorcycles, or walk, they'd do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hatchet Force was for that. Reactionary Force, if a team got in trouble, the Hatchet Force would come in. And they were very, very loyal to the Americans. And we had some NVA and some VC under the Chu Hoi, you know, open arms
mm-hmm.
program.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I'll tell you, when they came to our unit and we started working with them, everybody was skeptical. You know, I mean, wait a minute, this is not going to work. But the idea was, he knew the terrain and he knew basically what was going on in the operations, and also he was leading the pack. That gave us the split second or two for that guy that he bumps into, if he does accidentally bump into someone. The guy that he bumps into will have more of attention to hold off before he shoots. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The 101st Lurks used to go out full black pajamas, communist web gear with all their ammo, some of them wore little coolie caps, everything, you know, just for the element of surprise. Okay, because if you're walking up and there's a trail watcher, he's going to hesitate, but he doesn't know you're not going to hesitate. I was going to try to tell you that SOG, you know, that's what they called the entire group,
mm-hmm.
was the most decorated unit in the American history. Okay.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. They had 4 Medal of Honor winners. That's a sore subject on our side of the house.
Why is that? Because you guys weren't recognized quite as bit?
Oh, no. Because they had, what they call a 1-1, a 1-0, and a 1-2.
Mm-hmm.
One being the team leader, one being a team sergeant, one being the radio telephone operator.
Mm-hmm.
That's 3 Americans, and they would have 9 to 11 hung. If you worked your way up, and if you survived, like I told you, it was over 100% one time,
mm-hmm.
Had been wounded. At least once, and they stayed. They just kept on staying. I mean, I wanted to stay. I could have winded up going when I over in the play coup. I could have went with a company of Mountain Yards, or I could have winded up on what they call alert teams that they used, but it was for cross border. And this was 68. So the reason they formed us was to relieve the Special Forces SOG to go start doing cross-border operations, and then we would do the Central Highlands and all of 2 Corps, along with this special little unit called B-36 that... During that transition, they did all the recon. I mean, they basically, it was a lot of volunteers too. Yeah, I'll go up.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have a good friend of mine that was in B-36 because I mentioned it to him. He said, you know about B-36? I said, yeah, I know about B-36 and Omega. You know about Omega? What do you know about Omega? And then I told him, he said, damn, how'd you know that? And I said, well, in them days, I didn't know that much. But back in 82, 83, when I was working with, I got to work with Colonel Bob Montell. Colonel Bob Montell was, when they were forming Delta Force, it was Beckwith against Montell. Montell wanted to stick with his blue lights. And stuff like that, which meant that each SF unit would have, Delta-like trained, company.
Mm-hmm.
That so they could do counterterrorism. It was blue light or bright light or whatever. Anyway, Charlie won over, Charlie Beckwith, he won over and he started, Delta Force, and nobody really heard about him until they, went and tried to get the hostages. And then, during the refueling process out in the middle of the desert, well, they had already lost a couple of choppers to turn around, so they were even trying to figure out how they could put everybody on. Yeah, but what they did was, the guys who were going on it, they took them to a certain area and they built everything exactly the same, by guys who were there. And they had, definitely had the intel, everything. But as, you'd imagine it, trying to pull an extra C-130, and drop the hose. Now, this is on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the people were loaded into it. But that's where you do it in combat. Now, if you wasn't in combat, passengers would get out and go on a 90-degree angle and be told to sit down while they refueled. Okay? But with today's high-speed technology, they're refueling out of the C-130. And basically they clipped each other, and you know, I think they lost 8 or 9 guys, and that of course put him too short, and he, you know, but what could he do? He didn't want to go in, and you know, he wanted to go in, and he wanted to try to limp in there, really, and then save these guys, and then hopefully the troops could come, but mm-hmm. they weren't going to come because they couldn't tell nobody about it. You know, the Santé raid, that's what that is. And they found out later that there was a mole with inside SOG, okay,
mm-hmm.
and up where they were, and one down in Saigon. And of course, when you call in an Arclay or a B-52 strike, of course, it's top secret, especially coded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't advertise where you're going to do it. Now, what happened was one of these guys, I don't know, B-5, B-6, whatever, who was fighting the nasty war in Vietnam, I mean, in Thailand, during Vietnam, he went downtown to see his girl, and when he came back, he didn't have the documents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened? He said somebody just, you know, came running by in the traffic and grabbed him and went. Now, I could see a camera, money, a wallet or something like that, but they were interested in one thing only, and that was just, I don't know who was carrying it.
But, right.
Or if anyone was carrying it, but I just know that what happened from that mission was that, you know, they were on the way, everything was good, but the refueling point, and a lot of countries did not cooperate for airspace, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, our guys were in Vietnam, and we come over to Thailand to stage out of there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because they had better, mostly they had better flight facilities, and it's easier to do it that way. So they'd go over there for a week or two and go in isolation, study their area, and what they were concentrating on, what area, and how they were going to do it and all. And then when you sit back and explain to the colonel, and his RTO sitting next to him, and his XO behind mm-hmm. him, you know, you get to see how they play this game, you know. Here's the picture, well, so what? It's a picture. It don't say Kodak 1968 or nothing,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, we just discussed that, I mean, when I got my retroactive award in '99, it took almost a year, some of these guys were getting it in 4 to 6 months. Now, I got my 100% finally in the end of January, and they gave me back. They gave me 100%, which adds up to maybe $1,700 a month.
Mm-hmm.
But it's better than not having your retirement pay.
Why so?
Well, in 1891, they cut the law that at that time, no federal employee could do both. The budget wasn't there. In other words, say I was in the Army for 20 years and I retired and I got sick and all, and they gave me 50% disability. They couldn't afford to give me 100% retirement and 50% disability, so they just took the 50% retirement and they give you 50 retirement and 50 VA.
Mm-hmm.
Dollar for dollar, you swapped out. Basically, if you was a colonel or above, you was paying for your own disability. Okay? in 1944, I believe it was, refurbished it a little bit, and that's when they started using females more. There are females in Delta. They traveled with, they spent a long time training, not as intense or subject matter-wise as SOG, but they will put on, you know, halo gear, mm-hmm. but they get mobile training teams. In other words, they grab a couple of aircraft and the team goes out to their location, mm-hmm. and does an on-site training program for them. So there's no interruptions. They get it done. Mm-hmm. You know, they're priority on the list. And, I didn't know about it until I went over the warrant officer company, because this guy who was first sergeant, he had already served in Berlin, up at the Bear Mountain, which was another one of our areas where we had hidden. And what tipped them off was Tet 68, when mm-hmm. this guy was putting out all this stuff about, you know, hey, they were doing this and they were doing that, and that thing came up missing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was running with a female. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether somebody, I never seen a kid come up and grab a box and let's say food in. Okay. They got a little bit more sense than that. So, you know, the government just sold them out.
Right.
Or, if you look at it this way, they didn't buy their way out. Because that was the whole deal. You give me X amount of money, and I give you 100% POWs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we ain't gonna be, you know, you're admitting now that you have POW, so why should we pay you? Well, you know, I seen the actual, plaque and all that of the guys who they believe, the last time they seen them, they were alive with the enemy. And so they put them in POW.
Right.
/ MIA.
Hey, Joey, let me ask you a couple of questions kind of
okay.
related to this. The term sheep dipping, basically taking someone out of the military service.
What?
Sheep dipping, SHEEP, then DIPPING. Slang, basically, that I've heard from other veterans about taking an individual out of the military service, kind of unofficially.
On paper.
Yeah, and then creating another identity for them to continue a more clandestine life in service, you know, wherever this is in the world, but in Vietnam, I've heard that this happened. Do you know anything about this kind of, taking someone out on paper, or either in assigning them black ops or your type of operations?
Yeah. Black ops. I don't know why they ever use that word, but, let's put it this way. The whole time that SOG was in Laos, they weren't there.
Right.
Now, the problem that we had with SOG was because of the flight in, going in, you had to go in, with stealth, so they used the Blackbirds,
mm-hmm.
But they were flown by the Air Force. They were a beefed up, thing that had a little bit longer range capacity, and they'd put them in, and then they'd go back to whatever camp they were coming out of, and they'd be there to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
And it started getting reports that, okay, we're going to do an arc light. Now, an arc light, maybe three people will know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them goes up and briefs President of South Vietnam. So maybe four people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But when these arc lights were going down, they go and do a bomb damage assessment, and they had just seen a regiment there, you know, maybe X amount of hours or a day before, and they're gone, and there's nobody dead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there was a mole in the system. Okay, there was somebody or more. Now, at first, they caught a mole inside a SOG, but he was doing minor stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There was only certain people that had access to arc lights. The other thing was power trip, and it's very easy for aviation especially to say, you say, I need 22 ships. And they say, hey, we only got 19 flying. Well, what do you say?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, we're going to go down there and check. God, they could rig it not to fly. But, and that was one of their biggest frustrations, just like ours, was that we didn't know whether he was sitting there or not. We just hoped to God that, you know, when we say, you know, we're in contact, we need this, we need that, and they say, all right, they're inbound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be take them 15 or 20 minutes, but they are coming for you, okay? And that's the slicks and the guns and a medevac, maybe. And the guns, when they had to, they would leave the formation and run ahead, you know, because the fact I would say, hey, I need the guns up here now. So they would take off and they'd just start strafing the area. And then the chopper, would tell them, and they'd tell the chopper, are they firing? Are they firing? And he'd say, well, hell yeah, they're firing. Why do you think you want to get the hell out of here? Well, we can't go in then. What do you mean you can't go in? You expect me to, you know, raise the white flag? That's what all this air support is going to do. All these mini guns from, airships and all, I mean, the gunships, they would be strafing, and these things can put around in every square inch in one run of a football field, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they would be running them up and down, and they'd say, you know, it's close, and they'd say, drop the damn stuffing, let's go. That's the only way, because if Charlie gets on the inside of the ring, 600 meters is danger close. If Charlie gets in, then say they 600 meters is the closest I'll shoot, and you're 600 meters away. Well, Charlie knows if he he's got the power, if the rounds are hitting behind him, he doesn't run away from them. He runs towards you because he knows the closer he gets to you, the less likely a chance that you're going to call it in.
Mm-hmm.
However, SOG has called it right in on.
Right.
And Captain Carpenter, I knew the Sergeant Major real well, who was the first Sergeant Dan Savalewski, he was one of the guys that got the Medal of Honor that just said, fire for effect. And they said, that is your, he said, I said fire for effect, you know, and he called in, you know, but he brought people back. If he didn't do that, they'd all died.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been totally overrun. Now, on the reverse end of that, something that really stuck with me and is still with me. We were a scout security platoon, so 99% of the time we would live along the edge of the medevac. For better security, because it's a prime target, and also to help out. Well, we had a, I think it was, the company was under attack, heavy attack, and an LT called in. Now, what I do, I call in, I say, give me a smoker, a smoke round, okay? And if you're good enough, and you should be, one more, you know, you see a smoke round, you say, you know, up 200, left 50, fire for effect, over. You know, you make your adjustment, and here comes your HE, your high explosive. Well, this lieutenant called for fire effect and a battery fire, and I believe it was, I think it was 12 rounds within, anyway, within 12 seconds, 52 men were dead.
Oh, my gosh.
From apparently fire. But he didn't want to call it in on it. He gave them, in being nervous and all, you have to have your coordinates, their coordinates you want, and get your distance. He called in his coordinates. And I know I was there, and that's the first time that we tied M60 machine guns onto the medevac. And we were even switching out with them. I mean, they were just, the medics were just, you know, they were so exhausted and sick. And we stacked 52 of them guys in a reefer, a refrigerated reefer. By this time, another company had gotten in and, you know, secured the area. And but
Shelley, what do you do with that kind of incident? How do you handle that emotionally?
Well, I would, it depends on my rank. Now, see, this is where I said why I don't know if I'd get in this program, because the way I thought then and the way I think now is different. I was calling it in. I was in E4. We didn't have officers. That's why we didn't get Medals of Honor. The highest we've ever gotten was a DSC. We had one guy put in for a Medal of Honor. He jumped on a grenade. He said grenade. He jumped on it. He picked it up. He threw it back. It didn't go off. There were two trail watchers, which he was welcome point, and they simultaneously seen each other. As he fired, they threw, and there were six of them, our guys. He jumped on a grenade, and that fast he'd get up, and he picked it up. Now, this guy had he was huge. He was one of my best friends, Jimmy B. Kessler. He had a scholarship to the University of Alabama to play football. He picked that grenade up and threw it about 10 yards. Luckily, it didn't go off. You know, he said, it weighed about 300 pounds, you know, but all this happened so fast. He said, you know, the guys hit him, they fired him up, and when he jumped down, he landed on a grenade, he picked it up and he threw it, and of course they were joking, and we're kind of, you know, sick in our jokes when we get back and everybody's okay. He said, Jesus Christ, Kessler, a big guy like you can only throw it 10 yards. He said, man, I picked it up. He said, let me tell you, that thing weighed about 200 pounds, you know, and it's like kind of a slow motion, you know. All right, so now Jimmy's pissed. Let's go get him. Well, they get up there and they see a blood trail and all. Well, trail watchers usually indicate that they're watching the trail for another unit, and that's what it was. It was at least a company or two. They came down to get them, and the FAC was up there by then and said, okay, you head this way and get to the LZ. And when they were on the LZ, Jimmy was pounding it, and that's when I got hit. Jimmy was just calling it right in. In other words, you're supposed to start and then walk it out, you know, but
right.
you don't, but you start, you want to start at 600 meters and walk it out. That shit was coming through the trees over top of it. But he said, fuck it. I'm going to kill these motherfuckers. And also what that did was it definitely held them back. And then when the artillery will stop, and as soon as that chopper goes, before he goes, here comes them gunships. And them gunships for the, God bless them, they come down there, and boy, they're just ripping.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear that stuff ripping, I mean, 10 yards from you. But, you know.
It's precise.
Well, most of the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, if it's not hitting me, and it's building a wall of lead, it gives me the maybe 6 minutes that I need to get out there, get my guys on there, and get out. That's all I need. And that's what they do. They come in low and scream, and they'll tell you, here I come. You know, we tell them, we'll say, you know, okay, look, fly east to the west at 50 meters. And he say, keep your heads down. You know, I've had artillery guys say no, and, you know, no, it's danger close and all, and see, because it's nothing, we don't talk for days. So when we make contact, we have a tendency to scream. We don't have much tact or bearing or communication ethics, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We tell you like it is. The son of a bitches are coming. I said, dump it, you know? And here comes a guy who's coming in, and he's saying, you know, I'm receiving fire. He said, are you receiving fire? Of course we're receiving fire. That's why you're coming to get it. But they're supposed to know that that fire is going to be suppressed at a certain time. I mean, the gunship can't be running back and forth, and then you come in because now you just wasted ammo.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all time. So just as you're that, so see, they want to get that chopper. They'll wait. They'll sit there and wait till that chopper starts to flare, and then they'll all stand up and shoot at that chopper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's what the gunship does, is he tries to time it so when they get down to that area for that time, they start really laying in the lead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they want to stand up, you let them stand up. Okay? But they lay down a wall of lead, and that gives you hopefully enough time to get your guys on to a slip. But we've had guys say, no, we can't do it. And by the way, we're low on gas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're low on gas and we're low on sun. And so we had contact, and you know, guys keep screaming contact and the coordinates and all that kind of stuff. And run a gunship, okay, he's flashing, he's running, and then, you know, I've also had him say, we don't have any,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm talking, what do you mean, sir, you don't have any choppers? We have two designated choppers to this mission.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're refueling, well, I'm not going to tell you what you say. And
no, you can go ahead.
You dumb motherfucker, I'm out here and I ain't got no way out now. They're supposed to be coming to me. okay? I've got dukes all around me. I've got gunships here, but I can't get out. I can't ride out in the goddamn gunship. I'll kill you, you son of a bitch, if I get the hell out of here. Okay? That's the bottom line. That's the way you put it to him. Fuck him. He's a pin-pushing motherfucker that ain't been out there, and he told me to go run and hide. I said, what did you say? Say again, over. Run and hide. How do you hide in somebody's backyard when he's already turned on the lights? You know? Oh, my God. I swear that on my children that happened to me, run and hide. Okay? Now, we have a support team. I told you about our teams. Our teams are in the field. We have Commo X-ray that are way out there because we cannot make Commo back. Now, those that come in need to be detoxed. You know, they need a few days off to themselves and let them get themselves, you know, cleaned up, get their head back on straight, maybe go downtown. And then they go into a support mode, pushing the teams out, and then a few days later, they're going out. Okay? Now, whatever, you know, the system is, when you get off of that aircraft, that support team is there to meet you. Okay? Now, we had a run-in, and we had nowhere to go, and they said, where are you going? And we had a huge naval gunship, 16 inches. I said, right there. He said, where? I said, to that goddamn boat. I said, let me tell you something, bro. They got to have some kind of boat on there to come and get us because there was nothing on our maps. And that's what FACT does. FACT says, wait a minute. 270 degrees, 300 meters, you got a little opening. We might be able to get in there. Well, as soon as we try to get in there, in fact, somebody's got to stand up and panel. I'm standing up, I'm paneling, and as soon as they get low enough, I get in and I go across and I help the door gunner lay down suppressive fire. Well, I'm hanging on the skid ready to swing my leg up, and I feel him pulling pitch, you know, and my feet are leaving the ground. And I look up at the door gunner, and he's pointing back, and I see that there's a small tree there. So, I look up, and here's Charlie standing up shooting, and I just drop down, and, you know, we laying down fire, and then now the guy had a better idea what he could get in, and then we just called in them gunships, and we were in a corner. They had seen us, and they knew exactly where we were, and that's as close as I had gunships on me, but I tell them, because these guys had chased us until we got to this little corner, and they waited. They didn't, you know, they got in a little L thing, and they waited, because they knew it was coming. As soon as, and here I am hanging, you know, I'm not a foot off the ground. We just started pulling pitch, and I realized, I looked down, I looked up at him, and then I heard, and I see these, you know, three or four, you know, groups stand up shooting at, and I seen a couple of them fall down, too, because our guys laid in them, the machine gunner laid in them, and I dropped down. So the next, so then, the gunships just, man, they made about five or six runs. Now this guy, when he came in, boy, he brought that sucker in there, and I, you know, you keep the panel in your pocket until it's time to bring it out, and then you gotta stand up, and it's a, just an orange panel square, and you just open it and close it, you know. But he knew where we were then, and then he came in there, boy, and he set that sucker right, he didn't have to set it down, he just had to get it enough to where I could get my leg on there. Okay, so then I ran up, and as soon as I was on it, another guy was behind me, and I helped, and then I moved over to support that side machine gunner, because we all were loading on one side, because, you know, but only a couple of them ever stood up again, and then they were down. It was one of them gunships. Yeah, they chased us, and, you know, but that one time I came off, I had a guy hit, and we lucky it was a ricochet, mm-hmm. but I told him, I said, I'll kill you, son of a bitch, when I get back. I swear I'll kill you, you pin, you know.
Did you, what did you do when you got back?
As soon as I come off of the aircraft, the support team smothers you. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's their mission. Hey, Joey, how you doing? How you doing? And they get your weapon. Come on, man. Come on, man. Come on. We got some beer. We got this one part. No, I'm going to brief, and they take you away. And they take you to a secluded area where there's showers, beer, food. And in other words, I was not going. See, the ATL and the TL receive the briefing, and they give the debriefing.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't allowed to come to the debriefing. And
because of your...
I was, there was no charges pressed against me. I wasn't invited to the debriefing.
Right.
Without a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would have struck, as soon as I seen that man, I would have attacked him. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we couldn't understand how our officers could do that to us. I mean, you know, you've got teams out there, and we have to have the helicopters static.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got to be in the air, because it might take them 30 minutes to get to us. And 3 minutes is hell. And when I tell you that they're refueling, you just, man, that was our biggest frustration. And I told you, our company commander, and I read it because I'm an historian, in his report, and he wrote, he was a damn good man. He started us, he formed us, and he told them what was wrong. We need aviation support 24/7 assigned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got to live, eat, and breathe together. We can't. And then I was doing cross-border operations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was first couple times out. Now, I had been with, SOG units and all that on their base camps. We learned a lot from them. I was with 24-year-old E7. They'd been over there 5 years, you know. Mm-hmm. And they thought we were kind of crazier and handy, some of the things we did. But, I knew that if the chopper didn't make it to you and you was over there, that they might turn around. Or they might not show up at all, or you'll never know because you're overrun.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, because that's when I found out about the blackbirds, and the first time I seen the blackbirds, okay,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I got on the camp, I knew right away where I was.
Mm-hmm.
But them blackbirds were static. You know, they were waiting. But in the later years, there became a conflict of power. Okay.
What do you mean?
Okay, the guy who is in charge of the squadron, right,
mm-hmm.
had to be the approving authority to release certain assets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't have time for that. I need this now. Well, to make, you know, he was going to prove his point, and it's real hard to argue against him when he says, what can I do? You want 8 choppers, and I only got 3 runners. How do we know?
Mm-hmm.
See, it's so easy for them to pull a maintenance whack on you. And General Abrams was in his briefing,
mm-hmm.
and this stuff went down, and we almost lost mm-hmm. some guy. Well, we did lose one guy, and this was SOG. And Roy, he yelled at him.
General Abrams.
Mm-hmm. He said, when the hell are you going to learn that I told you, you will provide the support. And I don't care. I'm not going to have this captain running around looking for your ass for approval. When we say we want, we get. You understand that? You understand what these men are doing, or do I have to send you out on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of settled things down. After that, they had pretty good support, but they could always get you with that maintenance. And you know, being in that situation, one or two birds, but he wanted to have the upper hand. He did not like the fact that an Army officer was controlling his aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the damn pilots were great. I mean, they were great pilots.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the guys that flew the Blackbirds, they were Air Force. They'd come in a heartbeat. Anywhere, anytime, any place, they would come. Okay? Because they grew up with SOG. But then this one, you know, squadron commander or something, he wanted to play, these are my aircraft. And Abrams told him, no, they're not your aircraft. In fact, he told him, you won't have the rank to have aircraft. I mean, he really ripped into this guy in front of everybody. And Abrams wasn't nobody to mess with. He was the main man.
Did it change things?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. You know,
mm-hmm.
There was still the animosity, and once in a while, you know, you might not get six, but when a man does that, this is the way I live. They would hear me arguing with the CO, and I argued with my CO when I was a first sergeant,
mm-hmm.
that you are wrong. I've been training troops before you was in, even thought about the Army. You're wrong about this, sir. It has to be like this because of this and this and this. If the soldiers feel and see and hear and know that you're fighting for their health, morale, and welfare, even if you lose, they're going to respect you. Okay? And that's the way I was brought up. Is the health, you are responsible for the overall health, morale, and welfare of that entire unit. That's the first sergeant job. He runs the company. He takes care of the enlisted men. He gets the training and the job done. Sir, you sign the papers and keep the people off my back. And that's what this guy promised me in our interview. Because
mm-hmm.
I told the sergeant major, I said, listen, this is kind of weird, you know, January 5th, 1994, and we're having a change of command, and we're both going in at the same time, and I ain't even talked to this man.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Sergeant Major, I got to let him know where I'm coming from, and you know where I'm coming from. He said, I know, that's why I hired you, all right, but have you sit down. Well, this guy, yeah, okay, no problem, Top, I'll take care of things, you're running, yeah, you know, you use a drill sign, you've been in the area. Shit. He was the worst officer that I could have asked for.
Mm-hmm.
In the job that I worked my whole life for to get, and I had superior NCOs, and I was teaching, there was only four drill sergeants on Fort Bragg. Nobody knew about them. Even the central issue facility that controls every piece of property, I called them up and said, yes, ma'am, my name's First Sergeant Wilson. I need some drill sergeant hats. She said, there ain't no drill sergeants in Fort Bragg, First Sergeant. I said, well, ma'am, I beg to differ with you, but I got four of them sitting in my office. And she said, oh, come on, First Sergeant, I've been here 15 years. I said, well, I've been here about 15 days, and I need drill sergeant hats. And what do I have to do to get them? She said, well, wait a minute, you need to talk to Henry. Well, to make a long story short, I went down to Fort Jackson where the school was, and I made a deal with the supply sergeant down there so they could swap one for one. And so they actually did order them in Fort Bragg because nobody knew. Mm-hmm. And the guy before me, he didn't give a shit. You know, but see, I was the first sergeant / senior drill sergeant. In other words, we had two committees, the Psychological Operations Committee that taught the PSYOPs, and they were PSYOP guys. And then we had the Civil Affairs Committee, which were SF, that taught Civil Affairs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we had a male and female drill sergeant for each section, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And before I got there, they were assigned to that section leader. And I come in, I said, oh, no, you're not in charge, you know, drill sergeants. You shouldn't even be in this company area, whoever formed this company, because you should be up on the hill somewhere, you know, drinking beer. I don't want you around me. You live and sleep and eat around my students. That's bad enough. I got enough problems. See, in regular military, the drill sergeants have total control of where they live, eat, breathe, and sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Then they move them to each training area. And then they return them at home. They never see them training guys again. Well, when they formed this company, they formed the trainers, the instructors, in with the company. So there was just too much time being spent. It's bad enough that I got to worry about four drill sergeants and maybe three or four guys in headquarters company trying to screw somebody. But when you got 8 or 10, I have 18 instructors that stayed with them all day in a classroom and then was there at night, and it was just, you know, I had to relieve a drill sergeant. He had my best drill sergeant. He had 6 weeks left. 6 weeks left.
Mm-hmm.
And he, because he was honest, he could have got away with it and said, I didn't date the girl till afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And that was 3 months ago, and now she's coming to live with me.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, okay, that's all I know. But once he told me, I said, you know, it was eating him up so bad that it was affecting his relationship with his partner.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew. And so he had broke the code. And the code of a drill sergeant is not to fraternize.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
After they graduate, you know, that's different. And I honestly believe what he told me was true. The girl called him. They had been falling in love with their eyes for 8 or 10 weeks. And she got a pass and was head trunk with 3 or 4 in the morning. And she was about 3 blocks in the barracks. And she said, come pick me up. He knows now that he should have said, no.
Mm-hmm.
And called the guy who's on duty and went and get her, or he should have went and got her and taken her, you know, to the barracks, but he didn't. He took her home.
Mm-hmm.
They had breakfast. They fell asleep. He did not screw her.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that. They never seen each other again, okay, until afterwards, then that she started dating, and one thing led to another. Well, the CO knows all this, and I don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
But the drill sergeants, they know everything. And finally, the drill sergeant came down and said, I can't take it anymore. I can't hold it in. Drill sergeant so-and-so was with a student. I said, whoa, now wait a minute. Wait a minute now. This is on the record kind of stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I got to know. She said, yeah, first sergeant, goddamn, she's bringing her down here to live. And I said, now, look, did he you know, what's the situation? I said, because if we go any further, I'm bringing out statements, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, she said, well, I'll make a statement. Well, that night he called me up and then he came over and he didn't want to get the whole company involved. So he just confessed. I said, listen, Drill Sergeant, if you say any more, I'm going to have to take you down as a statement. And he said, that's what I want you to do. He said, I got to do the right thing. It's tearing me up, and I don't want to have a 1506. That means that everything gets investigated and all that. He said, I'm just going to admit to what I done. I said, okay, hold on. And I got his paperwork, and then he admitted it. Because he admitted it because he was honest, but also because they knew. You know, she knew. She knew that something had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it just pissed her off that he broke the code.
Mm-hmm.
And he only had 6 weeks left.
Why do you think he did this?
Pardon me?
Why do you think he did this? I mean, if your code is so tight.
It's... In the spur of the moment, something like that, you got a girl that you feel like you're falling in love with.
Mm-hmm.
And she's off, so nobody's looking for her.
Mm-hmm.
You think with the wrong head, you're only human.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he felt that, you know, okay, I did it, but I didn't do anything, and I got her back, and nobody's going to find out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these men, these trainees talk, and they go to drill sergeants, and it goes around and around and around and around and around, and they sit them down, and they talk to them, and then finally, you know, somebody's going to say, she left here, and she went with drill sergeant so-and-so, and I seen them, and then they get statements, and it's, you know, that's how it comes down. And so, rather than, he said, look, I'm just going to, you know. So, he was a superior soldier. Superior. In fact, when we gave him his efficiency report, he had several excellence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because where he screwed up in was... judgment, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, judgment and stuff like that. Even the CO didn't think him that bad, but it was enough to where we were going to have to let him go. Now, when we went up to see the colonel was pretty stern, but, you know, he knew that it took a lot for the guy to come up. He admitted it, so he didn't drag it out. And he respected him for that, but he just couldn't understand why. Of course, who can? Then the drill sergeant said, do you have anything else? And he said, I'd like to request if I could keep my badge. So see, the sergeant major, makes the decision. The sergeant major and me make the decision whether the guy keeps his badge or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant major said to me, what do you think? I said, he's keeping the badge. I don't give a shit. He's keeping the badge. I believe everything he said. He didn't touch her. Hey, love sucks, mm-hmm. you know, but he did 2 hard years. I wanted to keep the badge.
Mm.
He said, well, Colonel might... I said, the Colonel doesn't have nothing to do with this, Sergeant Major. This is NCO business. And I say he keeps the badge. And if the Colonel says no, then I want to see the Colonel. He said, all right, Joey, take it easy. You know, that's what he told me. I said, well, it's our business. Because what did he say? When he asked the Colonel said the Sergeant Major will take care of that. Well, we're taking care of it. You ask me, and I'm telling you. The man made a mistake. He admitted it. He's paying his dues. He's going to get out of the service. He's keeping the badge. He kept his badge.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Of course, the other drill are saying, I said, get over here, drill sergeant. I won't get that piece. I said, don't you ever contradict my decision.
Mm-hmm.
I was a drill sergeant when you was getting off the goddamn school bus. You understand me? Yes, sir, sergeant. Get out of my area.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you have to be.
Joey, tell me about the loyalty and the code within your LERP unit.
Well, I'll tell you, it's still there today.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little incident. I can't remember when it was. I was had a rough night, and I was sick Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and, you know, it was my lower right lung, and I felt, well, this is it, my shit's shot now, this is it, I'm going down, so I isolated, got really depressed, I didn't go nowhere, and then I blew up, and we got a little forum chat web that we put together for the unit. You go in there privately to sign in. And it's been going pretty good. It's only just started, about 6 or 8 of it. And from going there every day, I just went in and I said, I've had it. Plus, one of the guys in our motorcycle club was murdered. Hit from behind the head. And they haven't even went out to... They haven't even investigated anything. They look at him, hey, he's a dead biker, you know. All the stuff is building up, and I was sick, depressed, and I freaked out. So from habit, I guess, I just went and I vented onto the PTSD site.
Mm-hmm.
And then got in the motorcycle and off I went. Well, my brothers got a hold of me in the motorcycle, you know, they yanked me by the head, and we spent the whole day together, and I calmed down. In the meantime, them guys called everybody, put it on the damn in code, like, on the web, and then, now they shouldn't have done this, and I told them don't ever do it, and the boss told them not to do it, but they still did it. They called the sheriff's office. And now, I don't know what they said, but, you know, what are they going to say? There's a Vietnam veteran that's crazed out, and we think he might kill himself or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to sit up here and hide from the world, and I was here when they came. But my dog, my labs, kept them at bay. I mean, I could hear them out there, it's a sheriff, it's a sheriff. Well, I just slowly closed that computer door, and they were here for almost an hour. They tried to get near the fence. I got a 6-foot-high fence, and I had a lab out back. The labs were just going back and forth. And then when you come up to my covered deck, you have the window, the door, and next to the window is every sticker you can imagine, the American flag, special forces, I support the local fire department, ambulance, you know, you gotta have that, ranger, all that kind of stuff. Now, I apologize for I went in when I got back the next morning. My wife stayed out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't say nothing. She knew, where I was at. She just lets me go. She got in the car and left. And, I was supposed to get on the bike and take off. But before I could, the sheriff came knocking on the door. But the neighbor down there, he told me the next day Man, the sheriff was up there, and I, you know, man, he couldn't get nowhere but the dogs and all. And he said, well, is he up there, his car? I was up there, and I told him, you might be out on your bike. I said, yeah, I was going already. He said, yeah, what happened? I said, oh, it was a false alarm. They thought that I had had an accident, that my wife had had an accident. I gave him some bullshit story. But I said to my boss, I said, this is great. Now there's a report that at 122 County Road, they had a call. Now, I didn't know it, but I told them when I apologized, I put in capital letters, who called the cops? I said, come on, guys. I appreciate the help, but if you read it, I was leaving. I was going on the road, and I was going to do somebody because of his murdering my brother. And they weren't doing shit about it. And I was venting on everything. What went through your head to call the cops? By the time they got here, I was gone. I would have been gone if I didn't get tied up. And when the boss seen that, he wrote me back and said, I told them, do not call the cops. That's not the way we do things. And he said, you're right. They're never going to get you. Unless you said, I'm locked. If a guy calls up and says, and I seen a guy do this, he locked himself in the bathroom with a shotgun. So here come the cops and all that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled up one morning, the club's over there talking about it. So they tell me what happened. And they said, it slipped out of his mouth. And the round went through the wall and almost hit his wife and a patrol lady. I said, oh, that son of a bitch is trying for PTSD and he almost killed his wife. And one of my brothers said, no, Brasso, he's going postal. I said, oh, he works at the post office. He said, yeah. And I said, what happened? He said, he's gone, 100%. And that's what he did. He stayed in there, and you built this big scenario up, and then the dumbass fired the weapon, and his wife and the patrolman were standing in the wall next to him, and lucky he didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
He said it slipped out of his mouth, you know? And, but, no, we have, let's put it this way, over the years, I can depend on these guys. I mean, they showed me that yesterday. I mean, they did get a little bit too carried away, and it came from their heart. But most of the guys that were smart called and said, listen, Brasso, whatever you're at, call me. Whatever time, call me, brother. We got to talk. You know we can talk this out. Something
mm-hmm.
like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Don't call the cops, okay? Because what are you going to say? Well, what's the problem? Well, we got, you know, he's in our unit, and he left a message that he was going to do this or that. I mean, they had to tell him that I was, you know, doing something because that sheriff was out there almost an hour. But I never answered the door.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, you know, please, I appreciate it. Don't call the cops. I said, I live in a town that has martial law, you know, and now they know where I live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was going to go out there, but I said, no, I'd already waited, and then I just said, hell, I'll just sit it out because I don't want to discuss my personal things with them, and my dogs are doing well anyway, so. But in that way, you know, now if they were 20 miles away, they would have all been here or they would have searched the town for me. You know, so that, especially since we're all, you know, got heavy manifest, any heavy PTSD, we really try to help each other.
Yeah.
And and it's working. It's good because you go in there and you can vent and you get pissed off and you can laugh. You can say anything you want and nobody knows about it.
How does your wife react to that kind of relationship?
I've taken her through counseling and all, and she put the animals, except for the dogs, away, and then she got in the car and left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she knew that I needed to have my space.
And she's okay with the tight relationship you have with your brother vets?
Oh, she wants that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. She says, you know, like she said, well, I'm going away this weekend, this coming weekend, you know. And she has a real good friend that's a veterinarian also in Houston. I said, oh, just leave me like that. I said, well, I'm going away the next weekend. And she said, where? And I said, up to Dallas at a Christmas party. And I usually take her every year, but I wasn't planning on taking her this year.
Mm-hmm.
Because today she did 2 days up there and all that kind of stuff. She gets tired and all that. But she says, okay, great. Just where you need to be, you know, no problem. So, you know, you'll take care of the place. I got the best. They don't come no better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've been through hell together and back, and I came in yesterday, and then I sat down. I said, now you understand that you had nothing to do with it. And she said, I understand. She said, you know, but it just hurts me to see you go through this because, you know, you try so hard to do everything good, and it just builds stress because you deal with a lot of idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was cool with it. We always sit down and call. And so everything's good now, you know.
Well, that's good.
In fact, she was over there. You know what time it is? She thought it was 1 o'clock she was going to call me.
Oh, yeah.
So I was busting him. Yeah, I got a few minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to write this guy, and I got to write him back again. And she's the one I was telling you about is, no, it's WW, the virtual wall. So he's putting this guy's star up there on, and then he says, check it out. So I do, I check it out. And what's he got? He's got the wrong unit name. And I said, okay, that's it. I said, let me tell you something here, Richard. I told you from the beginning, I know there's another virtual wall.
Mm-hmm.
I've been dealing with this virtual wall, and if you go in there, it says the virtual wall. They're much more professional. And I said, they get the job done. I have a very good working relationship with them. I sent them a very nice letter of appreciation, which they probably, I'm the only one hanging on the wall, probably, that ever thanked them, you know, for all that they have done for our unit and everybody else, because I know it's a thankless job to sit there and get 1,000 a day, you know, for each man, remembrances, change this, change that, no, I wanted this, no, this, that, you know. So then he started telling me, well, could you tell him? I said, I'm not talking to him. I don't want nothing to do with them. That's why I told you in the first place, they can't even get the guy's unit right. I said, I don't know if you turned in the name. Well, yeah, you turned it in. Well, we were not LRRP in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
In September 67, everybody went from LRRP to LRP. And then in 69, everybody went from LRP to RGR, Ranger. So, you know, and I was typing that up when she was telling me, come on. I said, don't worry, I got a few more minutes. You know, but she's real good, you know. She just knows that it's frustrating because I've been such a self-achiever and I'm a workaholic. and in the club. I mean, when I came out of service, I just worked with the club, and I've always worked with the unit behind the scenes, mm-hmm. you know, because I helped form it. But I've never held office, and I never was in the political part of it. I've always stayed in my arena where I felt I belonged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the historian.
Mm-hmm.
And, but when all that gets added up sometimes, you know, she says, well, you expect everybody to do things, you know, the right way,
mm-hmm.
All the time. That's just the way you are. You're kind of anal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, basically, you never left the military. And that's what the guys say, too. You know, you're still in the military. I said, bullshit. This is a motorcycle club. Motorcycle club is an organization. You have officers, you have soldiers, okay? You know, that's how you survive,
mm-hmm.
okay? You don't bitch and whine and shit like that. If you do that one, go join the goddamn hog club. That's what that's for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You got to work together. We're supposed to be a brotherhood, you know? If I tell you a week ahead of time that we have to go somewhere and support this run, and there's supposed to be 30 of us and 10 show up, the other 20 have fucked me. You're not my brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You know, so things like that. So she's put up with a lot. But, you know, that's what I'm doing now. I'm going back online, and I got pissed off, and I said, let me tell you something. I'm trying to be patient with you, Richard, but I told you at the beginning, I know every damn wall there is and every damn monument and memorial and everything else on this site. I have been with the VVMF since the beginning. They have always treated me professionally. We have worked out everything, and I told them that I, as a unit, we gave them, you know, it was like a certificate of appreciation, just a real nice thank you for a job well done, and we understand that you have a thankless in job that, you know, but you put up a lot of stuff with us, but you professionally handle it, you always work with us, and, well, that is our major fault.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know what, it's the only thing hanging up out there. And he said, I want to thank you because, you know, I said, that was true. I said, Sergeant Major, I said, now you guys are probably sitting there. He said, you're right, we're in cubicles in front of a computer all day, and each man has 6,000 requests, you know. And I know I put you through a lot of hell. He said, yes, First Sergeant, but you've always explained yourself, and you've always thanked us, and this means a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I know what it's like to be, you know, on the thankless end. And since then, I just write them and I just say, I put in a remembrance. And the remembrance is really, I tell them what I want done, and I sign it to a historian, and then they do it. You know, so, you know, I mean, I got a good rapport with them. And this guy's got this fly-by-night scene, and, I mean, thing, and to make corrections, you got to do this. And it's just not as professional. And I tried to tell the kid nice. But see, the kid or the man, I think, is living out. Sergeant Lee was like Sergeant Rock. He never thought he'd get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And he died real quick. A sniper, boom, he's done.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that. Wait a minute. The Rock don't die. So now he wants to, you know, he says, I know you don't, you know, put up all their awards and all. I said, wait a minute. I said, we've buried men that have DSCs, okay? And all of our CIAs are heroes. Whether they have a DSC or a Bronze Star would be, it doesn't matter. They're all heroes. That is not an indicator of who's better. They're all equal. They all get the same treatment, and they all get the best treatment that I can find. And I find my best treatment at VVMF. You know, and that's it. I'm not going to get involved with that virtual wall and start another 3-year process that it took me to get where I am now. And I can guarantee you that if you go and check all my KIAs against anybody else's KIAs, we have a very nice setup. Our remembrances, he's got the unit patch in there, and it describes what their son unit did. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like a biographical thing on what their unit did. And it pumps up your chest just reading it. Like you're saying, damn, he's some bad dude. But we were. I mean, we were. We were the best. You know?
How do you all keep up with the number of KIAs? Did you do a count every time, or you just have it in your
No, these are the KIAs that were killed in Vietnam.
Okay. Not personal or unit KIAs.
No, these are the unit. These are the.
Not your unit or your personal recollection, but this is for the overall war.
No, I take care of my unit's KIAs.
Okay.
I mean, I can tell you where they went to high school. You know
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
And I am dedicated to them getting nothing but the best. They will do it for us. They will have the best. Whatever we can get. We've got them on the SOCOM wall, down in McGill, a whole slab just for them. And we've got them on the Ranger walk. You know, we brought them. And we're going to put them in the 1st Battalion who took over our herd each when they were formed. Mm-hmm. That has to tell you something. Okay? When they formed the 1st Battalion, who did they choose? They chose Charlie Cummings. Out of all the 13 to 19 Ranger companies, they were assigned the herd each of Charlie Cummings. And we, of course, had the heritage from Merle's Marauders. And we've got that old seal brown thing that says, you know, and all, you know. So I told him that. I said, you need to read Shelby Stand and go to page this, and page that. And, you know, so he's getting under my skin. You know, he keeps... Then he's sending me, like, I need a copy of the guy's Silver Star. I said, listen, we know what Sergeant Lee's awards were when he got to the unit, okay? This is when it happened, when he got in November 67, okay? And then he came to, you know, Echo Company. I said, you know, we're well aware of his, you know, great service record, but we don't put down in our remembrance the medals. We don't say he won this, he won that, but a lot of his friends or family or somebody else might say that. There's one guy that slips in out of nowhere. He's a historian type, I'll have to write it down for you. And one of our guys who got the DSC, he just put awarded DSC. So you're interested, you click on it, you read it. And I think that might be his assignment from somebody because, you know, he's done it on a couple of our guys. Clay Morton, I think his name is or something. That's what he does. Okay? So, if my guy's got a DSC or something, I don't have to worry about it because he's already got it in there. But, you know, that's not what it's about. You know, I think reading about what we did and what your son type of unit your son was with, and the unit patch came out beautiful. Have you checked it out yet?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Recently?
No, not in the last week or so.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I get worried because I go in there, you know, like once a month or so, and every once in a while, I'll lose a picture here, or a picture mm-hmm. there, but
I'll be sure to check on it.
Yeah, but I.
So you really enjoy this work now. I mean, this is a. It sounds like a cathartic healing process.
I started it at the beginning. I'm number three, third member. So I helped. I was a co-founder. But what happened was, once we got the wheels rolling, we had no orders. Everything was classified. I mean, we were putting together rosters by names and KIA. We had a guy on there. Up until last year, it wasn't even in our unit.
Wow.
But see, we had 8 Parkers assigned, and we know a Parker was dead. And with that, see, we've got 2,000 documents sitting up at NARA right now. Now, we don't know what they are, but they released 2,000. And we still got thousands more that we don't know if they'll ever release. And we were with so many units that I might be working with the 4th Infantry Division, and their intelligence officer gets the after-action report. Now, does he send it to my unit? We never know. Mm-hmm. He probably doesn't send it. He makes it up the way he wants it to, and they do that. And then he files it because we're attached to them. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. that was my struggle during PTSD. I have the letter, and I'll send it to you. It says, records do not exist. No records exist for that company in 1968. Now, that's telling you something.
Oh, yeah. So this idea of sheep dipping.
Exactly.
It's a reality.
We did not exist. They said, we have some entries from September to December 1967, but no records exist for that company in 1968. So, you know, we were top secret stuff, and so you weren't going to get none.
And you still can't today really get as much as, what, you can't get the complete record today, is that right?
We'll never get them. We'll never get them. We'll never find them because we were a poor asset. We worked with the South Vietnamese, the Koreans, and every American unit that was inside the Two Corps area. So after we come off the mission, like I said, the unit who's using us, their S2 or intel are the ones who do the after-action report from our briefing, mm-hmm. okay? Now, unless you got a really on the ball, and we might be up there with a platoon, so you got what, a first lieutenant, what should take place is that they could forward a copy of that after action report to our headquarters. Did it happen? Mm-hmm. Not no, but hell no. Mm-hmm. So we would have to buy, you know, how many units we worked with. We would have to pinpoint what time frame, what was the name of the operation, and what unit he was with. And they say, okay, we got 487 pages. Or we got 4,870 pages. It'll cost you $172. Test to find out if you even got it.
Mm-hmm.
So, no. It's, you know, mm-hmm. but when we started, we had nothing. I mean, and we didn't find out until last year an SF guy called one of the guys and said, look, I happened to catch your web, and he got David Allen Parker. Well, David Allen Parker died on my SF team.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, whoa. So we backed up, we retracked, and we retraced and everything. Come to find out, where is he buried? Fort Sam Houston. I go over, I look him up. Damn if he didn't. He died with SF. He was a grunt in the Cav. And from November 67, to, yeah, 67, he went with SF. Well, he figured he went home on leave, then went with SF, and 3 months later, he'd be dead. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some reason, when they said Parker, it's our Parker that got killed, in fact, wasn't killed in combat. He was killed in a boat training, and the body wasn't recovered. But we put him down on the KIA list, but we put him, died as a result of a training accident, and then they said body recovered. No. He went under, man, and, you know, we were doing boat infills. I wasn't. I'd done it before, but, and, poof, that was it. He was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So we still put him in, you know, in memory of him, mm-hmm. he's, but it was just crazy that it was a Parker, and, you know, but we had, I think, 8 Parkers in the 4 years in existence. So things like, you know, in memory of him, mm-hmm. he's, but it was just crazy that it was a Parker. And, you know, but we had, I think, 8 Parkers in the 4 years in existence. So things like, you know, in memory of him, mm-hmm. he's, but it was just crazy that it was a Parker. And, you know, but we had, I think, 8 Parkers in the 4 years in existence.
This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Joey Welsh. Today is December 14th, 2005, and I'm again in Lubbock, and Joey's in Castroville, and it's approximately 2:21 p.m. Central Standard Time. Joey, we were talking just a minute before we began recording, and you had some news about your Ranger tab. Can you tell me about that?
Well, due to what we considered an historical oversight, the qualifications for a Ranger tab is the Commandant of the U.S. Army Infantry School may award the Ranger tab to any person who successfully completed a Ranger course conducted by that school.
Right.
However, the commander of the Total Army Personnel Command and the commander of the Total Army Reserve may award the Ranger tab to any person who is awarded the Combat Infantryman badge while serving during World War II as a member of a Ranger Battalion, 1st Battalion through 6th Battalion inclusive, or in the 5307th Composite Unit Provisional, which was Merle's Marauders, mm-hmm. where we, you know, or to any person who was awarded the Combat Infantryman badge while serving during the Korean conflict with the 8th Army Ranger Company,
mm-hmm.
as 11 October 1950 to 27 March 1951, or to any person who successfully completes the Ranger course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there wasn't even a Ranger school then, okay? You know, what they did was they took all the Second World War II Rangers, and when they made a tab, authorized them to wear it. And they did the same with Merle's Marauders, who we took our lineage from. And then they did the same with the Korean conflict. Now, in our situation, I only think we had 2 Ranger qualified guys in the whole company. I was the first sergeant, and then another NCO. In them days, really, you had to be an NCO to even go to Ranger school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, once we got over there, you know, it was all volunteer, and then you had to go through a selection process. You know, they weren't going to send us TDY from Vietnam to go to Ranger school. And we were getting real short, the infantry was getting very short of NCOs, so they started a shake-and-bake program. Meaning the guy, the good trooper who goes through basic training, infantry, and jump school. If he's really good, they put him through like 2 weeks of NCO school, And then they sent him to Ranger School for 8 weeks. And then they sent him to Vietnam as Sergeant E5 and expect him to lead a team or a squad, an infantry squad. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we got some of them that left. They went out on one mission, said the heck with this, because they weren't trained, you know, for that. They were trained, and when they got to infantry units, I've seen many times he'd be an E5 and he'd say, all right, you just pay attention what this Spec 4 tells you, because he's been here 7 months in country, and you can forget your little 8 week sand table school. This is the real shit. Okay, so on 1 February 69, they took all the LERPs units and designated them letter ranger companies from the regimental combat arms system. And they took the heritage and lineage from Merle's Marauders, which was the 75th Airborne Ranger Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, all they did one day, we woke up and they said, okay, everybody puts on this patch, you know, and a mm-hmm. black beret. Mm-hmm. Job's the same, but see, it was unauthorized. It was authorized to do on paper, but we didn't have a regimental headquarters. We were still assigned to our parent unit, even though we wore the scroll and, you know, A and B company were over here. And they started with my company as C, and we went all the way through to P company without a J. They were just, you know, like 13 or 14 LERP units were just went right down the line, C, B, E-F-G-H-I-K-L-M-N-O-P.
Right.
Okay? And they gave them scrolls and all that kind of stuff. You know, we spent 10 years there, LERPing and rangering. And when we returned, there was no ranger units formed yet. In fact, they formed them. They deactivated my company, Charlie Rangers, on October 71. Then sometime in late 72, they reactivated it in Fort Benning, Georgia, under 197.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an A company and a B company. And we didn't even realize this, because, you know, Colonel Howard, I've talked about him many times, that he eventually took command of that company. See, we had heard that it had been done, and DA was saying I was just a paper drill. So we got some orders from guys assigning them there. It was Company C, Airborne Ranger, 75th Infantry. No, Company C, Airborne Ranger, 75th Infantry, 1st of the 29th Infantry, 197th Infantry Brigade. So, you know, I wrote to Colonel Howard, and because it was on his resume as being one of his assignments. And he said, I'll be damned if you know, they weren't real. He said, they fired the son of a bitch that, you know, I took his place. And Colonel Howard, that's the way he was. That's why we loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said they were the post honor guard. They were the Ranger School aggressors. And I wrote up the whole TDA MTO to deploy them to war, and you know, and then in October, November 1974, they formed the 1st and 2nd Ranger Battalion that we know of today.
Mm-hmm.
So he got, he was only there 10 months, and he got orders and went to be a company commander at C Company 2nd Battalion. And the rest of the guys were dispersed between the 1st and 2nd Battalion. The 1st Battalion formed, took our lineage, C Company, 75th, as there, out of all 13 companies, we were chosen, and which we feel honored, and we had gotten ours through Merle's Marauders, but ours was more of a paper drill, because when we come back, we couldn't wear the scroll. We did, but they would say, take that off, but as long as you could find a major or a colonel or somebody is still wearing his,
mm-hmm.
you'd say, I'll take it off when Colonel so-and-so does. You see? so we never, it was never an authorized scroll, and they never gave us a Ranger tab, even though they gave the World War II guys Ranger tabs and the Korean, and they never went through school. And we know the average time that an infantryman in all of World War II or all of Korea had 44 days combat time, mm-hmm. where infantrymen in Vietnam in a one-year tour had about 231 days of combat due to the air mobility capabilities of that helicopter. Pick them up, take them over there. Pick them up, take them over there. Mm-hmm. And that's really why it worked out that way.
Right.
You know, but after your year left, your year was up, there was no Ranger units in existence. Mm-hmm. There was a LERP unit still in Germany, but then they came back over and they were A and B. That's where the LERP started mm-hmm. in Europe. In 5th Corps and 7th Corps, long-range reconnaissance patrol in the late 50s, mm-hmm. okay? One of my good friends was in it. I mean, they were the pioneers of that, and they used the long-range reconnaissance patrol, mm-hmm. which we started in 65, 66. Then they came up with, no, you're all going to be, instead of being... Okay, instead of being the 1st Brigade, 101st Airborne Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol, you're going to be now F Company 51st Long Range Patrol. Okay, you know, mm-hmm. that happened in 67. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they needed to move SOG. CCC, you know, the two core areas out of Vietnam. They needed them to start doing cross-border operations. Mm-hmm. So that's why they formed our company, which was a core-level company of 230 men, the largest company in the unit, I mean in Vietnam, mm-hmm. was so that we could release the... this is declassified, so
yes.
So that they could release the CCC, which is Command and Control Central, or MACV SOG. You had Command and Control North, Command and Control Central, and Command and Control South. Mm-hmm. Okay, SOG, you know. And then they, you know, went and did their cross-border operations, and they took half of our company from... They did this in the 2nd Corps, 1st Corps and 2nd Corps, which was 1st Field Forces Vietnam and 2nd Field Forces Vietnam. I was in 1st Field Forces. Mm-hmm. They took half of the company in September 67 from the 101st LERPs and just raped them, and then half new great guys, volunteers, and, you know, they formed them at Phan Rang where the 101st was. And until they got, you know, the people they needed. And then they went up to the Central Highlands and played coup in the, you know, northwest. And they set up there, and they rotated them through the MACV Recondo Special Forces training and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, below us in the 2 Corps area, which ran from Saigon straight across to Cambodia, they formed the 2nd Field Force LERPs, and they got them from the 173rd LERPs. However, the best thing about them was they also assigned them a squadron of helicopters. So they had total air support wherever they went. They eat, lived, breathed, and fought and died with their helicopter pilots, which was a heck of a lot easier than what we had to do, because we winded up, I'm sure you've read Shelby Stanton's book. You probably got it sitting right next to you.
I got it right at my desk, actually in my office, absolutely.
Okay, write down this page number, a couple pages number for me.
Okay.
He's probably done the most research on every single company and how it was formed and the whole thing.
Yes.
Okay. And at the end, on the last page, he'll give the results. You know, he gives, like, you know, his overall thoughts, you know, of what that company was,
mm-hmm.
you know, how they did it, how they did. So when they did us, they called us Typhoon Patrollers or something, you know. in the first Field Force Ranger, I was in two corps, tactical zone, but the first Field Force Rangers, okay, which was organized, basically they were doing what we called Project, you heard of Project Delta,
mm-hmm.
Project Sigma, well, that was Project Omega,
mm-hmm.
okay? And they were all, and they had the rad mountain yards and all, they needed to be released. So, what, you know, they needed to get them cross border. They couldn't do South Vietnam. So they formed us, okay? So, on page, well, it's got some pictures and all that, but let me do this real quick.
Are you talking about order
okay.
of battle?
Yeah.
Is it order of battle?
No.
Summons of the trumpet?
No. I'll give it to you.
Okay.
Anyway, what they did was they released them once we got settled in. And page 277,
okay.
227.
Okay.
227 will give you, that's the last page of him writing about us.
What's the title of the book?
Combat Recon of Vietnam Rangers of War, Shelby L.
Yep.
Stanton.
Got it.
Okay, yeah. You know, you could read, I read just about, well, I read the whole book, but that's mm-hmm. where I picked up on it. And then on page 312,
mm-hmm.
okay, it'll explain how the Ranger battalions of today were formed and how they took the heritage of our company and assigned it to the 1st Battalion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great book. I mean, he did a lot of research, but I read every one of them and, you know, trying to be, you know, an eagle kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I read it 3 or 4 times, and I'll tell you what, it definitely tells you right there that the Typhoon Patrollers and Charlie Rangers performed admirably during the Vietnam conflict. The 1st Field Force Rangers probably confronted and identified more enemy units, conducted a wider range of Ranger-type combat and training functions using both conventional and special warfare techniques, and served in more jurisdictions than any other Ranger component. Company C saturated 14 provinces in 2 corps tactical zones, with Ranger patrols performing crucial reconnaissance for U.S. Army, South Vietnamese, and South Korean forces. Most important, the remarkable wartime record of Ranger Company C vividly demonstrated the high degree of flexible success achieved by a corps-level Ranger endeavor. In the conversation.
So that, what page is that? Are you reading?
227.
Okay.
That's his overall,
Mm-hmm.
And we came basically out on top because, I mean, geez, we had no air support. We'd go down and we'd be doing, we had one platoon, 173rd, one was 101st, one with 4th Infantry Division, one with the Korean, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And whatever they had for air support, then we'd have to use it. And boy, that's critical, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When you call up and say you're in contact and they say, well, there's no chopper. What do you mean there's no choppers? Would there be refueling? Well, in our sister company, them choppers wouldn't move like they're not supposed to. You know, they're designated for, you know, that special mission.
Mm-hmm.
And when you went in further into CCC, they had the Blackbirds, which were basically all black,
mm-hmm.
and they were flown by Air Force guys.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they lived, eat, breathe, slept with them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have that, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I told you that I was going to see that. I don't know if we talked if I've seen since I've seen In the Shadow of the Blade.
Yeah, we talked about it last time.
Whew. I'll tell you what. I don't believe there's any other units like us who appreciated them more. Okay, because when you got four men, five men, and you know, you're basically there are no friendlies. That when you get at that level, it's not like you're going out in front of your battalion five clicks.
Mm-hmm.
But we would go where intelligence was given that something was going on, something big. So don't go sending in a company, you know, where they bring in all the helicopters, everybody knows. You go in there and you sneak and peek around in this guy's backyard and let us know what's going on. And if anything happens, we'll come and get you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know. But I know if it wasn't for their tenacity and the balls the size of an elephant, I wouldn't be here right now. I'd be either dead or an MIA
mm-hmm.
on several occasions. And that goes for just about any team that had that. In fact, we did lose entire teams. And SOG also.
Let me ask you something that you know you very much demonstrated. You have a tremendous knowledge of the history of your unit, and in my experience, it's almost unparalleled with veterans and their knowledge of the unit in which they serve, from the very small squad level all the way up to division. And your personal research into this over these years, can you tell me a little bit about that and why you've done it and
well,
what it means to you?
You won't believe it, but, well, I had a good mentor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, in 1993, what I'm doing right now, requesting Ranger Tap, Colonel Grange, whose father was very famous, General Grange, Colonel Grange, who was the 7th Regimental Commander and was a Ranger platoon leader in Vietnam when his dad was a colonel in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when he finally got to that position of being regimental commander, he knew that we deserved, you know, to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1993, I had just returned from language school and I was working in USASOC headquarters, Army Special Operations Command headquarters, mm-hmm. waiting for a first sergeant job. Well, he sent down that due to a historical oversight, I believe that, like the Rangers before us, World War II, Merle's Marauders, Korean Rangers, that all LRPs, LRRP, LRP, LRP, Rangers, and BDQ. BDQ is the Ranger Advisors that work with the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
you know, were overlooked, you know, and I believe that we should try to attempt, he would like to, you know, honor them in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we sit down, we say, now this, of course, is, Fulberg Colonel, who's dated June 9th, he's changing command in July. By the time it was dated like May, but this was going to be, I guess, his big hoo-ah on the way out, but by the time they gave it to me because I was the only guy in the entire unit who was in one of them units.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, oh, well, you're the man. So I had to go and ask him, what do you want? You're not getting the scroll. I had already been through, you know, the archives and it's a question of lineage and history.
Mm-hmm.
We are were not part of the Ranger lineage because we were all under parent units, even though they made it up that we were, you know, under, 75th Rangers, we were really under 1st Field Force, or you was really, your parent unit was 101st.
Mm-hmm.
So we could be part of their history at the time, but not their lineage.
Mm-hmm.
So we're never going to get the scroll. The scroll was never even authorized.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do? So they said, what do you recommend? I said, well, you know, they just put out the Special Forces tab. Now, when we came back from Vietnam, if you were Special Forces and you weren't qualified, they tell you you had to go through the class.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy said, excuse me? I said, yeah, you have to go through the Q course. He said, I just spent 5 years in Vietnam with Special Forces. Screw you. So they started leaving.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then they realized, wait a minute, these guys should be teaching this course. So they made them automatically Special Forces qualified. Then when they made the MOS change, because it used to just be an S on the end of an infantry, you know, S mm-hmm. for Special Forces, P for paratrooper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the general was real smart. He seen that if I put them under an MOS, people or persuasions or sex cannot get in. Because when we went to formation, when I was with Special Forces, everyone had to wear the same headgear.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have fat, pregnant Green Berets running around, or cooks wearing Green Berets. So it lost its, you know, significance. So what he did is he changed the entire MOS system so that once you completed the Special Forces course, you was awarded a Special Forces MOS, and in so doing that, you was also awarded the Special Forces tag. So no one could wear the Green Beret unless they had been through that course, was had that job, and was awarded the tab.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you left the unit, you could always wear your tab. You know what I mean? If you mm-hmm. went to another unit for a special assignment, but you didn't wear your Green Beret.
Right.
It's like a Ranger tab. Okay, now, they said, well, what are you going to do about the guys in Vietnam that didn't go, you know, to their course? And they said, okay, anyone who served 120 consecutive days on an A detachment or alert team and was awarded the CIB, Combat Infantryman Badge, or Combat Medical Badge,
mm-hmm.
okay, in Vietnam, is authorized to wear the Special Forces tab. How'd they look at that? Well, they looked at, well, the school's a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is my analogy.
Okay.
School's a year, and you spend 4 months, and you live through it in Vietnam on an A team or alert team, you definitely been through more than the course could ever, you know, give you.
Right.
So, when I went to the, when the Ranger guys came to me, they said, I explained that to them, and they said, well, geez. And then I explained to them, look, everybody got the Ranger tab, but the Vietnam Rangers. And they said, well, why is that? And I said, I don't know. The colonel's trying to tell you that. They said, well, that's what we want. We want, and I said, what do you want? We want anybody who served in the LERP, Ranger, BDQ from a certain time. Now, let me tell you, now you're talking about making a retroactive award and a changing the entire regulation.
Right.
Okay.
Pushing this again, Joey?
Pardon me?
Who's pushing this again?
At the time, it was the regimental commander,
okay.
Which was May, June 93. In July 93, he changed command and left. And I'm still busting butt. Plus, I was sent down to Fort Benning because the Rangers have this nice little yearbook kind of thing. It gives their history
mm-hmm.
all the way from back in the frontier days. They get to World War II, and they get about 7 or 8 pages. Korea, 7 or 8 pages. Vietnam, they had 2 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went into their existence. So they wanted me to, you know, I got a hold of all the companies and sent out a format so that we could introduce that 10 years of Lurpin and Ranger into the 75th history. We're allowed to be maintained at their history. We're allowed to be at the regimental level, and we're allowed to be maintained at Carlisle Barracks, where the War College is. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to do that, it took us 9 months of research, because we had to, first of all, give a description, give a reason, and then list every single unit. Now, remember, they changed names twice, so there was three. So from this period, we would have all the LRRPs and what, you know, when they were formed, when they were turned over to be LRPs, and then when they were turned over to be Rangers. And a friend of mine that helped me, he's one of the best I've ever met. Unfortunately, his son, who's a 20-plus year Marine gunny sergeant, got killed about two weeks ago in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Boatman. He was over there for the 173rd LRPs, then the 54th Detachment, and they became N75th Rangers. And he lost his leg from the knee down, and when he was the guy I told you about when they came home, the doc was going to discharge him.
Mm-hmm.
And he called up 5th Group Commander, and Command Sergeant Major Komodo, and said, "Hey, you ain't discharging him. He's going to HALO committee, and he spent 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But from him, and just when we formed the company 20 years ago, we had nothing to go on because everything was classified. We didn't even know who our KIAs were.
Right.
We had guys that were killed that weren't killed, and we had guys that were killed in September, and really it was November, and, you know, so it took a long time for us to come where, as far as we've come.
That must have been very difficult for you and for the others.
Right. And our parent unit, which is the 75th Ranger Regiment Association, they're the parent unit for all, here we go again, LRPs, Rangers, BDU, BDQ, the new Rangers, and LRSI,
mm-hmm.
Long Range Surveillance Units, from Vietnam till present.
Is that a problem?
Well, no, it's not a problem for us, because we're not turning our, everything they want to have, we're going to die. We're dinosaurs. So who's going to take care of our website?
Right.
So they want us to turn it over to them. Well, who we turn it over to? You.
Mm-hmm.
And them. But mm-hmm. we know that, because we're very particular about how we run things, and when they said that they want the information, I told them they wanted to do it. I told the boss, I said, no, we will give them the information so that it has unit cohesion and it'll be done the way we want it to be done. Now, when we die, we don't know what the heck will happen. So that's why we sought out you. Did you get that article?
Yes.
You know, you're number one in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we did a test on you through my little stuff.
I figured you probably did. I actually
passed. That's what it was. It was a test, and I'm throwing all this stuff together and throwing all these magazines. I didn't know what to do, and, you know, I got the worst one in there. I think 6 pages was all classified because they were, you know, they say, just put anything in there. We just want to see how it works. And
Right. Really,
that's what it was.
Well, I passed that article along to a lot of people, and it made a lot of folks happy and a lot of folks proud about our reach and about people realizing what the Vietnam Archive is.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're definitely on ours, and you are also on the In Search of the Blade.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, In the Shadow of the Blade, you're a main link under there.
Yeah, we work with them.
Yeah, they're great. They just put the Rangers on. You said, geez, you're right, Joey. What would a high school kid do if he wanted to know where the LRP was? Where would he go, Joey?
Yeah.
And I said, well, you go to 75th Ranger Regiment Association. She said, oh, okay, great. So now she's put them on as the main link.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, helping her out and helping them out.
Yeah.
They're going to put in my web.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm supposed to even get some clicks. And all. I'm trying for this 15 minutes of fame. But, Doc, I don't know if I'm going to make it. You know?
Well,
you know, it should take a long time. You know, I'm adding up all these minutes here and there. My wife's always laughing. I said, man, that's got to be worth 30 seconds, you know?
Yeah.
And she laughs, you know? Now, this guy that we have this little group that we formed. We built, this guy built a private forum for PTSD Rangers. We sign in, you know, and it's, right now it's just a guy, some guys in our unit. And it's just there to just say anything, do anything you want, and, you know, just get everything off your system. Well, one of the guys, JP, says, you know, I went in and I heard him say, well, you got yours as a congressional. Well, let me back up. What happened was we got this big packet together. It was unbelievable. Perfect. Now, it went to the United States Army Special Operations Command, General Scott, my commander.
Mm-hmm.
He approved it. It went to the United States Special Operations Commander in MacDill, who's the commander of all branches. Mm-hmm. And he approved it, General Downing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But this was after it was turned down by the regiment because the new regimental commander would not endorse it. I was the first sergeant. It was January 94. And they said, you need to be over at the general's conference to talk to the 75th Ranger Regiment commander. I said, okay, fine. And a friend of mine that worked along with me a little bit, you know, he sat there, and it was Colonel Jackson, and he said, Sergeant Walsh, you know, First Sergeant Walsh, I'd like you to explain this to me. I said, well, what needs to be explained, sir? I said, read it. You know, I said, they gave it to the Rangers in Korea, and I went on and on and on. He said, yeah, but you could have went. I said, no, sir, we couldn't. I said, there was no TDY in return, and no one below the rank of E5 or E6 went to Ranger school. All right?
Mm-hmm.
I said, so he said, well, how'd you come up with 30 days? I said, well, sir, I told him about the special forces, came up with 4 months. What is that? A third of their time they would spend in school. Your little school, excuse me, sir, Ranger school is 8 weeks long.
Mm-hmm.
We figured if you come to our company and you survive past 30 days, okay,
mm-hmm.
and you get a CIB or a combat medical badge, then you've done more than 50% of the school in combat. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the last hard class was. He kind of glared at me, you know. And he, my buddy, he was a good friend of mine. He was a captain, and he was there to take notes in case, because I was gone. I just left a month ago. And that guy, boy, he asked me every question. What about my guys that, you know, jumped out and got killed in there? I said, what about them, sir? God bless them, they're Rangers. You know, I said, but yours is a different era. Your people have a regiment.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the regiment first, and then after 6 or 8 months, then you're sent to Ranger school.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have the choice. There wasn't even the option of going to Ranger school. It was OJT and Mac V. Recondo school.
Why did they have a hard time understanding this? I mean, it seems like it's factual, it's there, it's on the record. And
well, if you, let's put it this way. The majority of the, well, just about every officer I met that was in a Ranger or a LRP unit was all for it, even though they went through the school too. But you see, when an infantry officer graduates infantry officer basic course, he's already been through jump school. He automatically goes through Ranger school and Pathfinder School, or Minimum Ranger School, and he takes his test for his expert infantryman badge, and so when he shows up as a second lieutenant in an infantry unit, he's got his ranger tab and his expert infantryman badge and his little bald-headed wings, because he's, you know, got to show that he's been somewhere. Where's he been? He's been to school. He got an E6, been in the service 15 years, and that's who he has to compete with, an E6 or E7 platoon sergeant. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So some of these guys go, when they're going through college, after their junior year, they'll send them to Ranger School or jump school.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Mm-hmm.
So they prime them. You know, they have their ladder to climb. And another thing was, it's like I'm talking about, you know, well, I'm going to get Ranger tab when I see it. You know, I mean, I didn't get the DSC, I didn't get the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, or the Air Medal, you know. You know, when they put me in for the DSC, the Medal of Honor guy here, I figured a downgrade is Silver Star. And they downgraded to a Bronze Star would be,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they don't understand, and there were no officers present to witness it.
And that has to rub you all wrong.
And the guys would rather have the scroll than the Ranger tab, and so would I.
Sure. So where are you in this process? What's going on with you now?
Well, where am I?
Yeah, with your Ranger tab.
Well, I don't believe what this guy did. You know what he did?
What?
He pulled up a little thing out of the Quartermaster Museum,
mm-hmm.
and it tells you what I just read you.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he put in a couple sets of orders. He went to his congressman and said, "Hey, look, they did it for them. You know, I should have gotten mine. Look what I did." And about 2 months later, he got his Ranger tab.
Hmm.
I said, "JP, I'll tell you, I spent 9 months." What happened was Colonel Jackson, the new regimental commander, after this hour of drilling me, which I drilled right back, and the captain that was with him when we were gone, he said, "Man," he said, "he couldn't get you." I said, "You're darn right he can't get me. How's he going to get me? It's just because he has not been in combat." And Gary looked at me and said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Look, he's got his Ranger tab, okay? It's like a ring knocker from West Point, okay? They hang together. But he doesn't have combat. Yeah, maybe if he was in combat, like Colonel Grange, and was with a Ranger company like Colonel Grange, he would understand that the men deserve it."
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the opportunity. You couldn't even be a jump master when I came in unless you was an officer. And they made $110 and we made $55.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So, I would have much rather got the scroll, but it wasn't authorized. That's the first thing I went for. So there was a lady up there, Miss Thomas, who had been running the National Archives for the 75th. And she said when she first met me, "Oh, Sergeant Welsh, here we go again." I said, "What's that, ma'am?" She said, "You know, I've been here 20 years, and this is about the sixth time that this has been tried. I don't know why you're going through it." She said, "But, you know, you're not getting a scroll, you know that." I said, "I know, man."
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Why?" I said, "Because we had no regimental affiliation, and we can't be part of their lineage, but we can be part of their history."
Mm-hmm.
And she went, "Well, Sergeant Wood, you must be doing your homework." 9 months later, when I turned it in, she called me up and she said, "I'm going to tell you something, Sergeant Wood. I never thought I'd say this, but if anything makes sense and should be approved, it's this package." And I never thought I'd say that to anyone, but you definitely did a good job, because you definitely related it to what exactly happened.
Mm-hmm.
Special Forces were getting their tabs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
we weren't getting nothing. And they gave World War II Ranger tags before there was even a Ranger school.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, backdated it. So, I, you know, I've just been doing it for so long because when we started, like, that's why I'm very adamant about, well, I haven't even got into your stuff yet.
Well, I mean,
we have so much coming at you that we're going to go in there and sit down with you and make it really, really professional. Right now, we're just loading you up. We got 2,000 documents sitting at NARA.
Oh, wow. That's excellent.
Declassified.
People need to know about
and
what you logged in.
And there's still thousands more, but we got 2,000, but we don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we got to call up, we got to reserve a couple copiers, we got to take a few proofreaders and a couple copiers, and if you're really good, I know a guy who did the SF web, he said, Joey, if you're really good readers, and when you go there from 8 to 5, you're lucky if you get 800 documents.
Hmm.
You'll be lucky. And he said, hopefully you've got documents you need. He said, because you're going to run into weekly inventory. You know, you're going to run into so many documents that are non-relevant, and it's going to be harder for you than anybody because Special Forces is always under Special Forces.
Mm-hmm.
You was under every unit. That's another reason. I'd be attached to the 173rd and say a team would go out and a guy would do something good. We would write it up on notebook paper and sign it. They put it in the thing. Now, the S2 that we debriefed might have been the 4th Infantry Division, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, his debriefing goes, of course, to his higher headquarters. But we don't know if a copy of that debriefing ever went to our unit or if it went the same, saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was going through PTSD counseling, in order to verify missions I was on, I got it right black and white, we wrote to NARA twice. And it specifically states, we have some records from September 67 to December 67, that's when they formed. No records for this company exist in 1968.
Wow.
1968. They didn't exist. In other words,
mm-hmm.
they were blacklisted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that, when we formed the company, we didn't have anything. Everybody just sent in orders and we started putting it together and slowly but surely. I mean, I had a KIA on there until a year ago that wasn't even in our unit. But we had like 7 Parkers. You know?
Yeah.
And somebody said, yeah, it was him. Well, what happened was they went into a virtual wall. He was on SF. He was a scout and he went SF, but he didn't make it too well. A couple months he was dead. And he seen our remembrance and he contacted us and said, wait a minute, guys, you got the wrong guy. That guy was on my team. So we backtracked it. And I did. It just so happens, where's he buried? Fort Sam Houston. I go up there, and sure enough, there he is, David Allen Parker, killed with the Special Forces Group.
Mm-hmm.
2 months after he got there.
Mm-hmm.
Our guy who died was David Wayne Parker, and he was killed in a training accident when we were doing small boat infiltration, and basically he was MIA. His body never got recovered. So he got pushed off as a deceased guy instead of a KIA because he wasn't KIA.
Mm-hmm.
But up until last year, we just corrected that. And you know, how we know? We just knew that somebody said Parker, and, you know. And but now, I'll tell you, and it's you know, it's very, very hard because when you're putting somebody's name in stone, everything's got to be right.
Of course.
And now I'm getting my 4th stone. I got Ranger Memorial, I have the Army Special Operations Museum Foundation in Fort Bragg, the one downtown, that big multi-million-dollar one.
Mm-hmm.
I got a brick there. And then I have down at McDill at USA SOCOM, I have a brick there, and they gave us a whole side of the wall for all of our KIAs to be listed next November, KIA, which was 173rd, because it's kind of ironic. We started with the 101st when we were formed, and we were attached to the 173rd when we were deactivated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we went, in my opinion, they were the two best units over there anyway. You know, we went from one unit over to the other, so they put us next to, and November Company wanted it too. So all of ours are, you know, one. So the guy down there, me and him, back and forth. No, it's spelled this way, it's spelled that way. And the name rang a bell, and I said, Joff, I said, how long you been down there? He said, oh, about 4 years. Where'd you work? He said, I was up at Bragg. I said, up at the SF Museum? He said, yeah. I said, around 88, 89. He said, yeah. I said, I worked with you before. He said, yeah, yeah. I said, on this, when I was in Oakview, first Special Forces, and I came back there. Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, okay, okay. I said, oh, which made our relationship go a little bit smoother, because he was adamant that these are the lists you got. And I said, no, my list is the correct list. All right. Now, you have three walls. You have what we call the virtual wall, or this, really, that's the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Foundation virtual wall. And then there is a real, the virtual wall. And they have, it's not as organized and all that, but they have one. And then you have another one that's called View the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you can get casualty status, and everybody runs it different. But the most professional one that we felt is the one we're on. Although I have taken things from the other walls that we didn't have, like casualty status reports. They don't show you all that. At the beginning they did, but they got real, they changed their format just so, you know, where does the guy live and who, you know. That's why they added a name with a face, because it was, you know, it was nothing. And then the remembrances came along.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, to end this, what happened was Colonel Jackson said, well, here's my recommendation for a sergeant. I'm going to recommend that it be turned over to the civilian 75th Ranger Regiment Association, and that they can take it and they can submit it, because I can't support it. I said, no problem, sir. I understand your position. Have a nice day. Boom.
That was it.
That was it. And then what they did wrong, I told them, I said, look, you've got, I don't know, we have a pretty large organization. I said, and they started getting retired generals and all that. And then it was all of a sudden everybody did this packet. And I'm sitting back there with Roy, and Roy was his secretary. And this was, this was 94. This is Sergeant 93, and I was 94. I was the first one. He said, I need you to come down there and square these guys away. I said, no, I ain't going down there. I said, Roy, you go to congressional. You have a large organization. You have all the ammo. All you need to do is to go every man, every single man, give him a copy of the packet and submit it to his congressman. And I'll bet you get it. You can't be playing around retired generals and all trying to, you know, play politics. And he said, well, come down there and tell them that. I said, you can tell them that, Roy. I said, because more people are taking credit for that thing that you and I spent 9 months to a year doing. I said, hell no. I said, it's very simple. Go, every man, take the package to his congressman. Now, when you got 500 or 600 former Vietnam Rangers and LERPs banging at your door, you're going to make a difference. You know, you don't have a little committee you've got 500, 600, 700 men. And what am I doing today?
Yeah.
I'm sending it in with, you know, it's taken me 20 minutes to build the packet.
Wow. That's incredible.
I know. And I don't believe it worked, but I got the guy who, you know, is in my unit. I got right in front of me. He showed me, he gave me 3 pieces of paper, mm-hmm. and he got the Ranger tab.
Mm-hmm.
But his congressman was a veteran. That is real, very, very, very important. That's what happened to me
mm-hmm.
on my last one, because mine wasn't a veteran, and he did not understand the system. And I had a Medal of Honor recipient who recommended the award and did everything. And, you know, he felt, he said, you're going to go up there and you're going to put on your Class A's. And I said, look, if he comes back a silver star, I'll do it, you know. And I think that's what he figured. They downgraded one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they downgraded it to 2, they didn't have a military person present when they did the presentation, and they did the presentation when he was out of town. Oh, he wanted to appeal it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no way, I don't want to go through this. But, you know, I mean, the Medal of Honor recipient, don't ever say winner, the Medal of Honor recipient, you know, we probably had more in this city up to the last few years than any city in the United States. I told you about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Talking about San Antonio?
Right.
Yeah.
I've got pictures of like 11 of them. And now we have Colonel Howard, who I've gotten to know because he was our guest speaker. And now we found out that he wrote me back to say, Brass, so I'll be damned if that was a goddamn paper company. I ran that company. So now his web guy called me up and said, oh, by the way, Brasso, I put your website on Colonel Howard's link. I'm like, what? I mean, there's not even a place to ask for this. I mean, you're talking to big hitters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He said, yeah. He said, no problem. And I said, well, I appreciate it. So then I went back to him. I said, well, you know, we're going to offer him, you know, give him a lifetime membership, and he's going to be our guest speaker next year in Branson.
Yeah.
And I said, we'd like to put his web on ours. Do you know how many counts he says, well, you know, this guy started Colonel Howard's web by himself. Colonel Howard knew nothing about it. He just went over 96,000 hits on that computer.
Wow.
96,000 hits. Plus he built B-52 and another one. But he said, oh, no, you don't have to ask permission, man. He said, you know, put them on there. He said, you're right. He was your company commander. I said, because, you know, we're going to make him an honorary lifetime member, and he's going to be, you know, getting, and, you know, most decorated soldier in history of Vietnam gets nothing. That's what made this guy mad. He's watching TV, and this guy, he heard so much stuff. You know, he had 3 times as much as Audie Murphy, and he changed the channel. Nobody covered it. So he got the ass, and he did all the research, and he spent over 2 years building that web, and all of a sudden, Colonel Howard started getting a lot more calls, and they said, yeah, we've seen your web. And he said, what web? What web are you talking about? This guy did it on his own.
Yeah.
And then once they met, you know, and then Project Delta, they asked him to do it, you know, this guy, so,
So that was your mentor. That was your example.
No, my mentor was Roy Boatman.
Okay.
He was my mentor when it came to anything to do with the lerp, 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 I mean, lerp, lerp, Ranger, BDU, BDQ from the first day, because he was with the 173rd, the first guy's Army unit, until the end. He could tell you anything. He could, anything. He could tell you, okay, H Company wins, or he could tell you that 101st Airborne Reserve became F Company 58th Infantry, LRP Airborne. Then they became Lima, and he can tell you the dates, the times. I mean, it was just, and then we had a National Guard unit come in for a year. Nobody knows about that.
Mm-hmm.
They were a LRP unit. They spent a year. I think they lost three guys, got about 200 awards, and left. Okay. I think they were one of the highest decorated, most decorated unit was SOG.
Mm-hmm.
They had more Medal of Honor recipients, they had more Purple Hearts, and they had a kill ratio of, I believe theirs was 142-1. Ours was like 52-1. And these guys were phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I met, when I was over there, I was with them on base camps a lot and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd be hanging out with this guy, and all of a sudden somebody say, "Hey, Sergeant First Class." I said, "How old are you?" He said, 24. I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, but I've been here 5 years."
Mm-hmm.
You know, so since he came into NOM, he might have started with the infantry, then LRPs, and then Rangers and SF, but he's mm-hmm. E7 at 24 years old.
Wow.
You know?
That says a lot.
And they say, they call him a different symbol for the team leader, mm-hmm. assistant team leader, and RTO. But once you reach 20 missions, you know, you're pushing it. If you make it to 20 missions, you know, you're going to die sooner or later.
Yeah.
You know. This is interesting. Of course, I'm not going to do it exactly the way they're going to do it. I'm going to get, if I can, I'm going to get, I kept two copies of that entire packet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't work hard for nothing. And I sent one to the 75th, which they don't know where it is, and I sent one to my company, so I know he knows where it is. But the actual request is maybe 4 pages, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's very condensed, but I'm going to try to get that and put it in. But this guy just said, send this now. My stuff's going to read, and what I did was I wrote them a letter of introduction about, I don't know what you know or what you've ever heard or if you even know what a LRP unit was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no disrespect intended, but, you know, this was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I explained it to them. We've been using this for a lot of guys going to counseling, PTSD and all.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just tell them, you know, realizing the importance of your time in such matters is I humbly ask for a few minutes of that time to lay a foundation for what I'm going to convey for your consideration of my request. I know not how much is known by you concerning the organization and mission assigned to long-range patrol rangers. Thus, I feel I need to give a brief introduction which will help understand the danger to life and the awesome stress it causes one, especially after spending 12 months with the 101st Airborne Division as a mounted scout prior to extending for LRPs. And then I go on and I explain to them, okay,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they were brought into existence and you had to be voluntary. The Army did not assign anyone directly. The unit members would be asked to go beyond, and you could quit any time. You could be thrown out by your peers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Later on after the war, Vietnamese officers interviewed stated that they feared the LRPs and Rangers more than any force in Vietnam. They even, just like they did with SOG, they actually had special tracker teams to try to hunt us down. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, and then tells our lineage goes back to Merle's Marauders. We are the sons of the Marauders. The Rangers pulled some of the most dangerous missions in the history of the United States Army. And, you know, and so, mm-hmm. this way, a guy will say, well, what the hell is a LERP? Seriously, I mean, how, mm-hmm. you know.
That's bad. Well, I mean, I guess it's understandable to a point, but it's a problem.
What we put this together for?
Yeah.
We put this together for the guys going for PTSD years ago. Because, you know, these guys sitting down there evaluating them, what the hell's a LERP? So it was sort of a lead, and they started, you know, you start reading about it again, you know. I mean, we had rewards up to our head from anywhere from $1,000 to $2,500 a head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, it's just something that he says, well, you don't need that. I said, it's going in. My stuff is going to go right down the line, you know, just so that they see. Also, you know, I'm on several, well, I got yours in there even. I even got a picture of my stuff with yours. You know, I'm in the Army Special Operations Museum Foundation Hall of Fame. I'm in the BFW's Members Hall of Fame. All that's going in there,
mm-hmm.
okay? You know, because this guy's got to me, you know, I got to prove to him, plus I've got proof of being a recondo instructor and a pre-ranger and school instructor, and, you know, I'm not taking it as lightly as he had a Vietnam veteran, I believe he was a captain or something like that, infantry. He knew his ropes. So they are all assigned a general. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a guy who's been around, okay, and has been in the service, you know, can relate to that general a lot more than some congressman who's never been there. That general just, you know, does what he, you know, has to do, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
that congressmen don't know the difference. But if you got somebody that's hot on the stick, and it works both ways, it makes the general's job a lot easier, too, because he can say, hey, look, sir, you know, we can do this, we can do that. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do this. That's mm-hmm. the way the veterans are.
Yeah.
That's the way soldiers are, you know. Hey, the guy deserves it, let's give it to him, let's go. Well, you know,
mm-hmm.
but he ain't going to talk to that civilian congressman like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Joey, let's switch gears.
All right.
I want you to tell me about leaving Vietnam in September 68 and what that was like for you, how you felt toward your men.
Well,
and what
of
happened.
Course, you know, I tried over and over not to leave. And they said, well, you can't stay. And I said, why? Well, you have 150 days left. And if you have less than 179 days, you get out. I said, I don't want to get out, so extend me 90 days and send me over to Special Forces. They said, okay. A couple of days later, they came back and they said, you can't extend. I said, why? They said, well, you got orders to Fort Bragg. I said, well, I don't want to go. I want to get out of the Army. And they said, well, you can't. I said, well, no, wait a minute. 2 days ago, you said I had to get out because I had less than 150 days. Then I said, okay, extend my ETS 90 days so I have enough time in the country to go stay here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to stay and you said, you know, you can get out. I told you if I wanted to get out of the Army, I wouldn't be extending. But if you think that I'm going to go back to Fort Bragg with 150 days, by the time I get there, I'll have 120, maybe 110, and at 90 days you become a 90-day loss, and basically you're ash and trash, you're crazy. I said, now let me out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. You come back, you got orders. I said, but I'm less than 179 days.
Right.
He said, well, I'm sorry, Sarge, the orders are cut. And that's era, and I had no records.
Mm-hmm.
Not one piece of record. Nothing. I had orders reassigned to me from the LERPs to 30-day leave to Fort Bragg. You know?
Did the people at Bragg know what you had been doing?
No. What happened was I went to the personnel center and I tried not to go. I told them I don't want to go. I wanted to go to California and reenlist to be a drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. No. Well, my mother had just recently had a hysterectomy and I had been gone for a couple of years. I want a medical hardship.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To Fort Dix. You know, because I wanted to stay in, I figured I'd stay in and be a drill sergeant. And they gave me 15 days extended leave while the medical board met, and they said no, because I had a critical MOS. Once I graduated Recondo school, I'm 85, your whole world changes,
mm-hmm.
because you leave the 11 Bravo and you become 11F. 11F4P, which was infantry operations and intelligence sergeant. If you put a P on the end, you're parachutist. If you put an S on the end, you're SF. So having that 11F series and having been in the units I had, was in, I was a critical MOS and was not to be released to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't want to go. I wanted to stay. I had the job. I was going over to B Company 5th Group. I probably would have been working with the Yards or a LERP team. And they welcomed us because we worked with them so much. And, I just said, no, you can't go. You gotta go. And that's the Army. I mean, one day they tell me, you can't stay because you need to get out of the Army. And I say, okay, extend me and I'll stay. We can't because you got to go back to Bragg. But I don't have enough time. I want to get out. I don't want to go back. I got less than 179 days. I'm authorized to be released from the Army. I said, oh, no, you're not.
That's interesting. When did they give you the medical leave?
What?
Did they give you the medical hardship leave?
Nope. My mother, who had, she was upset. Well, the first time I came back, she said, oh God, oh great, you're back. Where are you going now? Back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Back to back was hard with her. And then, she just seen that I was in a mess, and she said, well, my doctor said, I talked to him about it, and he said that he would write a note saying that I'm a mess because you are making me a mess. So the Department of Army extended me 15 days, but they didn't tell Fort Bragg. So on the day I was supposed to leave, I was already 15 days late. I didn't go. I turned myself into the MPs at Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
And said, I'm not going.
Okay. Yeah.
I said, I'm not going. And then they locked me up. I was in class days, and I sat in a cage all night, and a little E4 paratrooper let me out the next morning. And he called down there, and that first sergeant was yelling and screaming. He said, oh, no, first sergeant. This is an excellent NCO. He had authorization. It was an administrative error. He's waiting on a medical thing. No, you don't have to send two guards. And then he hung up and said, Sergeant Welsh, you got to get on that plane now. So, October 16th, I winded up getting there. And I had about 122 days.
And when the 122 days ended, what happened?
Oh, no, Welsh. It was about the fourth day, and I was... What happened was I met an old sergeant major from Special Forces. What are you doing, Welsh? I said, man, I'm trying to get the hell out of here. He said, you want to be a drill sergeant? I said, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he reassigns me to TRADOC. So I leave 82nd. I go down there. I'm there 2 weeks in processing. And he calls me and says, Joey, he says, I'm sorry, I can't keep you. What do you mean? UMR, Uniman Ross. I can't put you on excess. So what are you going to do? He said, you're going to have to go back to the 82nd replacement. I said, back to the 82nd replacement? I said, man, I only got like 2 months, And he said, go back there and see if you can reenlist. Boy, I walked in there on a Friday with no orders, and they said, what do you want? I said, I was sent here from Trade Out to report it. And he said, do you have orders, sir? I said, no. He said, well, we don't want you. So it was Friday afternoon. I left. I went home. Monday morning, I came in. They charged me 4 days day walk because my order showed up at 4:30 in the afternoon. And you are no good, sorry ass, son of a bitch, son of a bitch, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I said, wait. And that clerk wouldn't stand up. I said, the clerk down there, you know, no. So I talked to him, and he said, well, show. I had nothing to show him. I said, I've spent 33 months in this, over 33 months. I said, I am a good soldier. I said, I did a tour in Germany. I was on my third tour in Vietnam. I said, bullshit, we ain't got nothing on you. What you do, throw your records away to hide something? I said, oh my God. So I talked, and then wait outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the guy said, well, I'm not going to give in, but yeah. You know, to me, getting Article 15, you know, for that, if I was smart, I should have just said, no, I'll take court martial. But I walked in there and he said, I find you guilty of absent without leave, and I fine you at $15 a month for a period of 1 month. So as I bent over and I signed that, and I stood back up and I saluted him and I turned around and did a 180, and the first sergeant said, Welsh, report to me in the morning. Right, first sergeant. That was it. My whole entire attitude went 180. And you know what job he gave me?
What?
Prison chaser. I wore Class A's with a loaded 45, and I flew around the country picking up prisoners for 2 months. And then they offered me, my buddy, well, I lived there then, replaced him. My buddy, I lived downtown, but my buddy was re-enlisting. He said, Joey, I gotta, you know, check you out before you leave. I said, well, he said, I'll give you a special forces medic course upon completion, guaranteed staff sergeant and $3,000. What do you say about that? I said, sign the goddamn papers.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Joey, man, you got to go. I said, sign the papers. I'm out of here. FTA. Fuck the Army.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It was crazy, you know? I mean,
having to prove yourself after all that time.
Well, see, they had over 70% of the 82nd Airborne had been to Vietnam at least once or twice. They were insane.
Mm-hmm.
When you came in, every guy that you process through, they have these little cages, you know, for finance.
Mm-hmm.
They're inside a cage, so you can't get at them. They're inside a cage, and the CQ, I worked at for a while, it had like a stable door cut in half. And you know a breaker bar that they use to switch tracks on the railroad? Did you ever see? In the old days, they used these.
Yes.
Okay. Well, right below, you know, it was a stable, like the door cut in half. And the guy was in the hallway, so he only had about 4 or 3 foot behind him, and he'd say, okay, you need to sign it. Oh, fuck you, man. Oh, I don't give a shit, man, about him. But wham! He just pulled out that damn stick and slammed him about 2 or 3 times, and he just collapsed. And that'd be it. Now, get your ass up here, sign this shit, and get up in your goddamn room, or I'll call the MP. That's what they had. A railroad switch breaker bar cut down, and it was right in this. You couldn't see it. The guy pulled right out, and you couldn't get away.
Mm-hmm.
He'd lean over, and he just whacked. You try to hit him in the shoulders, you know, or the arm, something. And, you know, they had me doing that for a while. But usually, the guy, I mean, I did it. You know, I didn't have any problems. I would have done the same. I would have ripped their heads off with it. But the guys they had in there, the first arm was about as big as a wall locker. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And he hired, you know, some guys that were short like me and put them there. And they'd have all 24 on, 48 off. And that was their job until they got out of the Army. And they're all like 6'2", 6'3", 220 pounds, you know. fucking, they got an attitude too, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had some people come through there who were crazy, man. You know, you're jumping junkies. I mean, they eat LSD and go jump out of airplanes and shit. They were crazy.
Mm-hmm. How'd you like this kind of job?
What job?
Well, the prison chaser.
Well, it was pretty neat because I was with this old-timer E5. Him and his brother had three whorehouses and two car dealers down there. So I was hooked up pretty good with him, and he had got shot in the foot, and he was just hanging out. So he was from New York, and I was from Philly. So, well, I don't know about it. Anyway, we were authorized to wear the weapon. Mm-hmm. On the plane, where we would go right to the front, the pilot would come out and give us a briefing, and we would go on there. We were like air marshals to them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But I seen a lot of stuff I didn't like. I mean, a kid was told to go home, like from jump school, and your orders would arrive. And he'd wait 2 or 3 weeks, and they wouldn't arrive. And then he'd go, like, he's not knowing any better. The closest thing was a Marine air station. So he'd sign in there, and what would they do? Throw him in jail, you know? And then, man, I seen some, you know, there wasn't any, well, the guy I was with, the big guy, the big white guy, took his place. He told the guy, look, I'm gonna take the handcuffs off of me. I'm not gonna make you walk through this. He said, don't run on me. Well, they were eating dinner and he took off. And he said, man, I grabbed my weapon. He said, I thought, you know, but I was gonna shoot him. Then he just tackled him and, you know, and, really cranked him up. Then from that time on, that guy, you know, his arms were, you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, most of the guys I had were in that situation. The other hard thing was, okay, you need to escort a prisoner from the stockade to jail, to a court, and then bring him back.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were doing to these guys for, I mean, I don't condone drugs, but, I mean, I seen a guy, had 2 years in Vietnam. He had two joints, and the civilians caught him.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turn him over to MPs, and he got, I'll never forget this one black kid, he had two little skinny joints.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him dishonorable discharge and 3 years hard labor in Leavenworth. I was like, whoa, dude.
Wow.
Whatever happened to, you know, treatment, you know? This was him getting off a plane to go to Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we did some crazy stuff because I'd call him up, and, like, I was going to Fort Devens. They were real well known for their treachery.
When was this, Joey?
1969. Okay. Yeah, because they were ASA. You know?
Yeah.
And they thought they were our spy guys. And, I call up, Tuesday and I say, this is Marshal Murray. He's looking at everyone visiting. I'm, here to have that. I'm gonna pick up private shit. He said, okay, sorry, when you want ready? I said, 9:30 Friday. I'll be there. Okay, click. And then we'd, go in the bathroom. We take off our weapons and we put them in a little AWOL bag. And we put him in one of them quarter lockers.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd jump on a plane or a train, and I'd jump on a plane or train, and we'd go home for 3 or 4 days, and then we'd come back,
mm-hmm.
hoping that our guns were still, 45s were still there, and we'd strap them on, and then we'd go pick up the kid. We picked up this one kid, and we had this 3/4 ton, and this guy, this little fat MP, when he came up, the guy went to put his hands on the bars, and he slapped his hands. I didn't say nothing. I looked, the black guy was watching. I didn't say nothing because, you know, I got a sign for him. And, man, this kid, he looked like he was 15. He's one of the kids who was sent home, and he stayed home, and then he winded up there. And, he came across, the guy grabbed his bag, and when I signed for him, then this fat guy with his gut, man, I pulled out my gun, I stuck it in his face, and my buddy said, come on now, Joey. I said, I'll tell you what, you son of a bitch, I'm from the 82nd Airborne Division, and if I ever come back here again, if I ever, I'll kill you. I had it sticking and squeezing in his eye, and he was down underneath his desk by then. He said, now, we gotta go. And all I had to do was squeeze his trigger. I mean, that's how close he was. I mean, he was, you know, man, I was just so pissed off, man. You know, that, I mean, who, you know, guy's holding on to the bars, man, he hits him with blackjack.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. And that kid, we went, you know, I'm with this big guy. I was with the big black guy. We ate the cheeseburger. That guy ate three double cheeseburgers in about 5 minutes.
Wow.
They hadn't fed him for nothing. He had no mattress, no blanket. Well, I told him, I said, you son of a bitch. I said, I'm from the 82nd Airborne Division. If I ever come back here again, I'll kill you. And he was crawling underneath the table and shit because I had already disarmed him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I popped his clip through it. I threw it into the, I said, hey, guys. And I threw the gun into the damn jail and ran. we took a roundabout away. We missed our plane, and we had to borrow money from the kids, the prisoner, to get out because we missed. Yeah, but
sounds like some crazy times.
Well, nah, you don't mess with an airborne trooper. And I could see the kid was, you know, he was a kid.
He got the message, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had it in his eye. And the guy was with me, you know, he knew I was getting, he was the big black guy that stood behind me, but I was the dangerous one, really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Joey. I said, but no problem. And as soon as I leaned over and I signed, that's when I did it. I grabbed him by the throat, put that thing, sucker in his eye, and he had a black eye. I said, how about I shoot at your eye? And there was nobody around, but the prisoner seen it right there. Yeah. He said, Joey, we gotta go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I whacked him, and I threw the gun into the prisoners and took off. So I think that kept him busy, you know.
Yeah.
He stayed under that damn thing because they got a hold of that gun, and that mm-hmm. gave us our getaway time.
So what did you do after this duty, after the prisoner thing?
That was it.
You got out.
Yeah, see, because once I went to become a drill, I was in recon for a week, 2 weeks, then they sent me out to be a drill sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
I took a few weeks, and when I came back, they gave me my Article 15, it was on my 21st birthday. All right. At that time, it was December 18th, I had November, January, February, I had 9 weeks left in the Army. They can't reassign you.
That's right.
So the first sergeant said, you work for me, Welsh. You know, and then after a while, he sees, man, you know, this guy's, you know, he put me on the CQ, figuring, you know, I see if he can handle it. Shit, I knocked the shit out of him. After a couple of days of getting to know the big guys, then he put me out on, you know, mm-hmm. chaser duty, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But see, in them days, it wasn't no big thing to have an Article 15. You know, you wasn't a good soldier if you didn't have an Article 15. But I didn't see it that way because I didn't deserve that one, you know.
Yeah.
And...
So what did you do after this? What was life like out of the Army? How did you make that transition?
First time I stayed in my room for 8 days, and then they finally called, my mother called my friends, and they got me out. The second time, I really don't remember. My father met me at the, now I remember, train station. I went home, took on my uniform, put it in there, and I never mentioned it to nobody. My parents, my family was very supportive. They never asked me anything. I got hooked up with the guys that I had known, I grew up with, that were in there, basically seven or eight of us hung out together and all, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really went into music, totally blended in, grew my hair, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have, you know, several really bad incidents. I got thrown in jail several times. A cop pulled a gun on me, and I charged him, and he jumped in, and I jumped on top of his car and kicked out all the lights. And then when I came down, it was like eight cops around me. They weren't real happy about that.
I can imagine. When was that? Was this after the first time or the second?
Oh, this was after I was out. I was attending bar, and I went out to have a smoke break, and there was an argument inside, I imagine, and the cop comes up and starts yelling in my face, and, you know, so I said, you know, fuck you, man, who are you talking to? You know, who the fuck do you think you are? And he started backing up, and he put his hand on his weapon, and I lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went after him, so he jumped in the car. Now, if I would have jumped in the car, and then I don't know what happened. I jumped on top of his car and kicked out all his lights. I was jumping up and down, and I'd have just shot. But then when I come down off of there, there was about, I don't know, five or six cops. And I said, let's go. Come on, come on.
Mm-hmm.
And then one cop, he was my, you know, my father actually years and years and years ago was in politics and got him into a job. And
mm-hmm.
his name was Joe Walsh.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Joey. I said, yeah, yeah, Joe. That's how I was, still with him, you know. He said, get in my car, will you? Okay, Joe. Because, you know, he knew I was going to go down fighting, but he said, mm-hmm. Joey, go get in my car. I said, okay, Joe. So they got me with malicious damage and all that, and it cost me $1,000 on the way out. I said, hey, Chief. He said, what, Joey? I said, that blue light belongs to me. I just spent $1,000. I'd like to have it. And the cops rolled back there, man. I said, that's mine. He walked back and got it and gave it to me, and I, oh, God. Oh, that thing grew over well. So, you know, I didn't look for trouble. It just, you know, I just, you know, really just. Then in 72, I went in a psych hospital. Finally, I signed myself in. And
you did that yourself?
Yeah, well, I was from a counselor, and they had diagnosed me with asthmatic bronchitis, and it was really acute anxiety, which I went up there, and they locked me up for a week. I flew over to Cuckoo's Nest, never even seen a Vietnam vet before. And after the second week, they let me out, and I had music therapy once a week, once a day, and that was to go down this big music room by myself and bang on all the drums and all.
When was this? 72?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, to this day, that's one of the best centers around.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, it was right out of one flew over to Cuckoo's Nest, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was in total lockup. There was one Vietnam veteran that was a heroin addict, and he just used to come in there to clean up and get his, you know, methadone.
Mm-hmm.
And they had never seen anything like, you know, what I was telling them. And there was this kind of team, like a long table with all these people, and I'd say, I can't take no more. They said, why? I said, because I'm hallucinating. They said, you what? I said, well, things are starting to move on the wall and all. I just, you know, I'm just getting too stressed. Anyway, make a long story short, the agreement with my brother-in-law was, I'm going in, and when I went out, you come get me.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down with them in the morning, and they told me, yes, yeah, you are misdiagnosed. You do have acute anxiety, you know, and mm-hmm. due to stress, combat stress and all that. I said, okay, fine, thank you. I called my mother, called my brother-in-law, and next day they pulled up, and he brought about six guys with him. And me and him and my mother went in, talked to the director, and said, please go. I said, I'm leaving.
Mm-hmm.
She said, what do you mean leaving? I said, look, I see you once a week, a group of bunch of people. You already said I had acute anxiety. Every day I go down to the music room and pound on drums. Okay? I've got my medication. I've been told what I have. And I'm leaving. You said, what are you going to do with me for the next 2 weeks? He said, if you stay 30 days, you'll get 100%. I said, I'm not worried about that. I just wanted to get my diagnosis right. You just told my mother and my brother-in-law that I have acute anxiety. So when we walked out, there was two or three big, huge black guys. And at the same time, about six of my buddies walked in and just did a semicircle, you know, and they looked up at me and they looked over at them. They just put their head down, shook their heads, and off we left. They turned me down. They turned me down. I was collecting 10% for asthmatic bronchitis. They turned me down for 30% acute anxiety because I went against medical advice and left the hospital.
And has that remained so, or have you been increased since?
Oh,
then?
No, I'm full tilt bozo now.
Why do you say that about yourself? Tongue in cheek, or are you serious?
No, I'm 100% PTSD.
Yeah.
But I'm not collecting 100% PTSD. I collect 100% disability, and I collect 100% Social Security, and I collect 100% combat-related stress compensation for losing my retirement. So, all tax-free, by the way.
That's nice.
Yeah, well, that's nice, but I'd much rather be normal and be in the back of an ambulance screaming down the highway than sometimes what I got to go through, you know. It took a long time. They just were really hard when I went back in the Army, and I couldn't go and tell them, hey, I picked up the TV and threw it out the window last night. I couldn't do that, wrecked my career. So what happened was, when my wife and I were in that really major motorcycle accident on July 9th, 1995, and she almost died, they say that as she progressed, I regressed, and the demons came back, and, you know, I still feel guilty for that. I feel guilty for leaving Vietnam. I feel guilty because it was an accident, but it doesn't matter. I dropped the bike, and, you know, and my wife, you know, the neurosurgeon said, you know, she's a veterinarian surgeon. She'll never operate again. She said, no. 8 months later, she was operating.
Wow.
You know, but it was a miracle, and, you know, but that's what happened. Her mother stayed out there with me for over 10 weeks. And she'd be there from 9 in the morning to 5 at night, and I'd be there 5 at night till 9 in the morning. And the Army left me there, and, you know, Special Ops First Sergeant came over, and him and I worked together. And then we both went for a job that I knew he was going to get. But I didn't care. I wanted this guy to know who I was because he was a big man. And, he always tried to intimidate. And I told him, anyway, I winded up getting a great job. It fit us both. But when I went down, boy, he was there. And he said, what do you need? I said, I need to leave. I need to, you know, stay here. I can't, you know, I can't go nowhere. I said, he said, okay. And he pulled out this little skinny phone. And he said, okay, well, locked in, he will not move, he will not go nowhere, he's permanently assigned to headquarters Army Special Operations Command. Do you understand me? Give me a call back in 10 minutes when it's on paper. Boom, that was it. How much leave you need? I don't know. He said, okay, well, don't worry about it. I had like 42 days.
Yeah.
But I went through hell. But she don't remember any of it. But she was comatose. She was dead. I mean, I was doing CPR, and then I went in mouth to mouth, and they pulled me off. And when she went into that OR, her her grasping skill, I think, was 3. And that's dead. You know, 15, yep. 15 is alert and oriented, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they said, I did good and all that. And I said, no, I didn't do good. Sure, she won't be laying here. And,
well, she pulled through.
Yeah, well, yeah, she had a fractured skull and she had a brain. They found, shit, 3 days later, 4 days later, they found out she had a lacerated liver. I mean, she had a fractured skull, which turned into a hematoma, and they had to go in, relieve the pressure, and put a drain in, and check the pressure, and then she was totally comatose, and lacerated liver, punctured lung, fractured ribs, broken hand, broken collarbone, and one little scrape on her face. And, and of course, I had somewhat of a medical background, but I was devouring everything. I had a great neurosurgeon, he'd come every day at 9. I'd say, well, how long do you think she, he said, I don't know. I don't know when she'll wake up or if she'll wake up. I don't know. I said, she'll get up. She'll wake up. So I went in there and I turned on Aerosmith and I played Aerosmith 24/7. And me and, like I said, I lived in the waiting room. I'd come on 5 at night till 9 in the morning, and her mother would come on from 9 in the morning to 5 at night. Hmm. About 4 or 5 days later, she started moving and all, and then it was a long struggle uphill because of the way they come out of. Now, depending upon what part of the brain it affects, you know, mm-hmm. if it's just your sleep portion, some people wake up and say, you know, they're fine. They can remember, they can hear, but they can remember people in the room and all that, but they just couldn't wake up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she was really bad. I mean, she was, you know, had to be on a life support system and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they say her age, her strength, and her intelligence was what was for her. The average kid, 19-year-old kid, 70% of brain injuries are they're the ones who get them.
Mm-hmm.
They usually wind up paraplegic because they explain it like this: like your wife has been so educated, and she's in very good shape. She's young and she's very educated, so she knows how to get from here to Dallas in 3 different directions from learning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a 19-year-old kid has been slopping around, you know,
mm-hmm.
he knows how to get there one way. Well, the brain, you know, as it tries to stimulate and seek these paths, the 19-year-old doesn't have a good shot.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of them wind up paraplegic or vegetative. Where your wife has 3 avenues, maybe. And if it finds that avenue, it starts the road to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And, they go through. She started, she finally got up and she didn't know who I was. She was talking like some college professor. She was talking words me and her mother didn't understand anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on and on and on. Now the whole time they had her on Dilantin. Now what they do is they take your score when you come in and then when you become aware again. And they average out that time. But what happened was they had her on Dilantin because any brain injuries can have seizures. So God, I guess she was in there a couple of months, but she was already into the rehab. He said, I'm going to start cutting back on the Dilantin. That was Friday morning. I went home Saturday morning. I was home an hour, and her mother called and said, "Joey, get back over here." "What?" She said, "As soon as I walked in the room, she knew me. Hi, Mom. How you doing? How you been?"
Wow.
And we don't know how long that Lantin held her down, so they could never say what her future would hold for her, mm-hmm. you know? And, man, I went and I grabbed the our wedding album, and I said, "Who's this, Barry? Who's that? Who's this? Who's that? Who's that?" And then, you know, and then we just worked and worked and worked and worked and just, you know, brought her back. But she looked like, when I brought her home for a visit, she looked like a POW. She weighed about 62 pounds. No hair. I cut her hair. And the nurse said, I said, "I need to cut her hair. Your mother and mother's in there." I said, "No, I'll take care of it." So I cut her hair all the way off. You know, just left a little bit. Nurse came in and said, "Thanks. You know, that's the best thing you could do for her." Because she couldn't, you know, she was bedridden, you know. And I knew from being in a working hospital that the last thing I need is long hair. And her mother came in and said, "Oh, my God, what'd you do?" And that's when nurse said, "Believe me, man, that's the best thing for her, you know, because... you know, body baths, all that kind of stuff that mm-hmm. she don't need." So, but she's a toughie. She's an Aggie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't be here. She's just, you know, stuck by me afterwards because she don't remember nothing. I told her, "Okay, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm putting that in the paper, saw the bike." She said, "Saw the bike?" I said, "Oh, yeah, and the bike's gone, baby." I already told her, no. I said, "No. I told your mother, my sister, well, I don't care what you told them. It was an accident. You know, I flipped over trucks before and destroyed my Bronco, and I've been thrown from horses. I want to ride." I said, "Not with me, you're not." So...
I didn't sell it
on the road, but not as much. And then once I got here, it's a different atmosphere. And basically, you know, mm-hmm. once in a while, we take her out. But I would just, but, you know, but I sold my bike since then. I got a loaner now.
Yeah.
But,
well, Joey, this might be a good time to stop
yeah.
our session today and pick up again next time.